Good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, December 5th, 2016. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern to midnight. If you're listening over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 712-770-4160, and our participant code is 385-698. If anyone would like to email a question, they can send the questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA directly by donating $5 a month or more. You can click on a donation tab on the top right. Okay, we'll start off again, as we usually do, with a scripture. Tonight's scripture is James chapter 2, verses 14 to 26. So that's James chapter 2, verses 14 through 26. What doeth it profit, my brethren, though a man say he hath faith and have not works? Can faith save him? If a brother or a sister be naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you say unto them, Depart in peace, be ye warmed and filled, notwithstanding you give them not those things which are needful to the body, what doeth it profit? Even so, faith, if it hath not works, is dead, being alone. Yea, a man may say, Thou hast faith, and I have works. Show me thy faith without thy works, and I will show thee my faith by my works. Thou believest that there is one God, thou doest well. The devils also believe and tremble. But wilt thou know, O vain man, that faith without works is dead? Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he had offered Isaac his son upon the altar? Seest thou how faith wrought with his work, and by works was faith made perfect? And the scripture was fulfilled, which saith, Abraham believed God, and it was imputed unto him for righteousness. For he was called the friend of God. You see then that how by works of man is justified, and not by faith only. Likewise also, was not Rahab the harlot justified by works, when she had received the messengers and had sent them out another way? For as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead. James chapter 2, verses 14 through 26. Okay, let's see. Tonight we're going to be looking at another paper we wrote. We've been writing quite a few papers. We've got a few memorandums we're going to be reading over the next couple of weeks. Tonight we're going to read a paper that we put together and wrote, it is to the U.S. Congress, both houses. It's going to be addressed to both the Speaker, Paul Ryan, and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Again, this is a redress of grievances. Last week we looked at the redress of grievances to the president, which we made some corrections in that since we had read it last week. And I don't know if anybody else has any more corrections. If they read it, get the information over to Jan. You can find his email address and his phone number up on our website under the directory. You'll find him. He's one of the national leaders. Also, we will be adding a little more on the president's one, probably another paragraph or two concerning the militia, probably two or three paragraphs concerning the militia, and a few quotes. I personally recently just read on all five or six of the past acts of Congress, going back to 1792, I believe, was the first one. There was two that year. There was an addition later on in the month. And then there was the 95, I think it is, and there was a couple others. And the latest or the last is what's referred to as the Dick Act, which is the Militia Act of 1902. Now, there was an update on that Militia Act. They added a couple of lines. One of the things they changed was they added males and females. Maybe we'll talk about that later. I know Brent has talked about that. But anyway, I have found some interesting things about the militia and about how they set things up. And it was back in the 1902 when they seem to have given the name National Guard to the militia. So when we read the National Guard, we're actually talking about the militia. And that's important to understand, and how they took the National Guard and sent them overseas. I know there might be some questions concerning how that whole thing was set up, but I think we have to work with what we have. We've got something from 1902. I think we need to work with that. I think we need, when we talk about the Act of 1902 and we refer to the National Guard, I think we have to make the point that that is the militia. We will be speaking, if we write a paper on it, here and after the militia, instead of calling it the National Guard. Now, whatever errors or corrections or changes that need to be added or taken away from that act, that could be discussed and worked upon. But we have something to work off of. But anyway, that's another topic. We're not going to get into that tonight particularly. But I do want to go through this paper we'll be sending out. Now, It looks like we will probably finish all of our writing this week for our federal case, which we'll be filing up in Albany. So hopefully next week, I don't know that we'll do it Monday, but maybe Tuesday or Wednesday of next week. But next week, we're probably going to do the filing. But we've had a contact, a message sent to us. I'm not sure exactly who sent the message, but ultimately it comes from President-elect's Trump's group through an individual who's assisting us in contact with him, coming through, I think, Washington. I think state of Washington. One of our members, Robert, is handling that connection. And it's been asked to us that we get all of our papers to him. They're very interested in reading them. They want it on disk, so we'll put it on the disk. And they'd like to get it within the next 2 weeks. I think that's when this woman that is the main connection to that camp is going to be meeting with them. They're coming, I guess, from Washington. I mean, coming from, you know, from Washington to Washington, D.C. to, or whatever, New York maybe, to Washington, state of Washington. So we should have no problems of putting all that together probably by the end of this week, beginning of next week. Probably getting into the mail, but maybe over the weekend, next weekend, so that they'll have it next week and in time for this meeting. So this is an exciting opportunity. We're going to put together probably, I'm planning on it or thinking about it anyway, putting together a series of YouTubes, and we're going to label it The Saving of America or Saving America, something like that. Probably The Saving of America, because it's through the process of we the people doing what we're doing to take back control of our courts and our political process. So we're looking to take back the judicial process and the political process. And we have to get the message out to the people, the necessity of educating. People have remained ignorant for whatever reasons. It is so serious and so severe that these things that these people that are doing to destroy our nation have been doing it right in front of our face, and we don't even realize it. Why? Because we're ignorant. We don't have the knowledge of the way things work, of what things are. You know, the fact that, let's just take the example of the militia. You know, they call it the National Guard. People don't think of it as the militia. No, we have to call it the militia. You know, regardless of some of the errors that need to be corrected with the act that can be easily corrected, and we can pressure Congress once we get control of the courts and eventually control of the political process, we can definitely pressure Congress to make the necessary corrections, if any, and additions to the law concerning the militia. You know, the militia in itself, the purpose of the militia is for the purpose of a free safe, free state. And it's to prevent an invasion, an insurrection, and to enforce the law. You know, if there's not enough marshals or whatever the case may be to be able to suppress a problem, to enforce the law, it is okay to call in the militia, which is the people, we the people. There's quite a few things I'd like to say about that I've learned, and maybe we'll talk about that after we get through a few things here, or maybe we'll talk about it in the near future. But nevertheless, this is the militia. And what did they do? They sent our militia. They've been exhausting our militia by sending them overseas to war. I was blown away to find out how many wars are actually going on right now that America is involved with, and how many conflicts and different operations that are taking place across the world, and how many nations that we have a presence in. I mean, I knew it was high, but I didn't realize how high it is, and I'm going to probably put a paper together on that. But it just blows you away. We are occupying the world. And they're doing it. The United States is doing this in the name of we the people. And one of the things we have to get through to President-elect Trump is that this is unconstitutional. He's breaking the law. The Constitution is not passé. It's not something that we need a new document for. No, not at all. It is the law of the land. And if people want to do things that's not covered in permission through the Constitution, then they need to ask the people, and the people need to decide what they're going to do about that. But also looking into the size of federal government. Again, some research we recently did in order to put these papers together, totally blown away. Unbelievable, the number of agencies. They don't even know. No place is there an accurate number of exactly how many agencies and federal offices there are. Nobody knows the answer to that. How could that be? How can we, the people, be that dumb, that stupid, to permit that to stand, that situation? Because we don't know about it. Why? Because we're not paying attention. If we were paying attention, we would know and not allow them to do anything beyond that which what we have given them the power and the authority to do through the Constitution. These things, a lot of these things that are being done can be done through the states. And it's up to the people of the states to make their decision, what they want to do here or there or whatever. Even there's limitations, though. But nevertheless, it certainly has nothing to do with the federal government. Federal government is so huge. And I know everybody knows that, but I don't know if everybody realizes how huge it is, how many people are employed and contractors are employed. There's something like 475,000 troops. Okay, we have an army of 470,000. Who would think of that size? I certainly wouldn't think it was that big. That's what we have spread around the world. I think it's 70 nations, or 70 countries, shall I say, not nations. 70 countries. And that might have been the low side. I don't remember. I'd have to recall the numbers. That might have been what it was, and it's now more. I think it was 120 or something. But what are we doing occupying or involved in all these countries? Why do we have forces everywhere? You know, they'll give us some logical answers. But look at, you know, Congress hasn't declared war since World War II. Constitution is absolutely clear that Congress declares war. The president can't declare war. Guess who, you know, only Congress can call forth the militia. The president cannot call forth the militia. The president becomes the commander-in-chief when they are called forth. Until then, he's nothing. And he can't call forth the militia. The people don't know this. Why they don't know this? Why don't they know that? Don't know this? Because they're ignorant to it. They're not interested in it. They've been trained or taught to not be interested. They were trained or taught that they can't understand it, that you have to have a college education to understand the Constitution. And that's ridiculous. We, the people, wrote the Constitution. It's written in plain language for the plain individual. That's what Jefferson said. So we it's easily comprehended. I mean, yeah, I got to look at a dictionary here, look at a legal, I like to use the legal dictionary, of course, some of these words, and once you know, oh, that's what that word means, okay. You know, it's clear, it's simple, it's easy, okay. It's written simply. Jefferson said, you know, these people come in, try to make things, something to say that it doesn't say, you know, and if you want to really know, go back to the argument originally back in the 1700s and listen to the we have this in tape and in writing, you know, the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers. There's the debate. You want to know the meaning, what our founding fathers really were meaning and wanted this to mean? Go read those papers or go listen to those tapes, and then you'll know exactly what was in the mind and the hearts of our founding fathers during that time period. Read their papers, their letters back and forth to each other. Find their quotes. This is all available for us. We're not taught this in school. They ignore it when we bring it up. But they'll ignore us only so long. That time of ignoring, I think, is coming to a clash at some point here. So, but anyway, we're going to add a couple of lines into the paper we read last week. We're probably going to add a couple of lines into the paper we're going to read tonight. So let's get to the paper. Let me see, I have it opened here. Yeah, I do. This is a redress of grievances. You can find a copy of this up on nationallibertyalliance.org. Highlight grand jury, click on docket. So go to nationallibertyalliance.org, highlight grand jury on the top blue bar right side, click on docket. And you'll find the papers we have. You're going to find a lot of papers showing up on this page in the next 5 to 7 days. We've got memorandums that are written that we'll be probably reading. I'll look back to see if we haven't read some of them. We have some that we just went through and perfected, so we probably haven't read them yet. We have other law documents that will be going up here, more evidence documents going up here. There's quite a few evidence documents already. We're going to be bringing up all of the habeas corpuses, all of the information and writs that we've written over the past year and a half or so that's been filed in all 94 federal district courts. They're going to be refiled in this district court, copied to these people, and they're going to have to respond and answer to some of these things. We got cases, information, writs. We'll be accumulating lots of affidavits for the different cases. Now, there's certain cases. We're going to open and go forward with the case out there in Oregon, which was the original wildlife case. And we're going to go after that judge out there and after some other individuals. We're working on things. We're also going out that way. I think it also, not sure where the, is it in Montana? Yeah, it's Montana. The case in Montana. What's that gentleman's name? Does anybody, Gerard, you remember his name? I know we were talking about him earlier today. Robinson, that's it. The Robinson
Joe Robertson.
Case. Thank you, Robert. Joe Robinson. So we're going to be opening that case. We're going to be doing a habeas corpus for Joe Robinson. We've tried to do one in the past, but we didn't get anyone to do a next friend for him. I believe we have that paperwork. We're going to be working through that paperwork. We're going to be filing these now through our numbers here in the federal district courts and doing show causes on why they're not responding and giving these people due process. Remember, habeas corpus is the statutory process of forcing a due process. The bottom line, you can't get rid of habeas corpus. To get rid of habeas corpus, you get rid of due process. You can't get rid of it. This is the point that we have to make and push to these people. These people are not getting due process. And who are these people that are preventing these people from getting due process? That's where we need to really push hard. So we will be filing every habeas corpus we did in the past, and I'm not sure the number. I just don't remember, 30 or something, maybe more. We're going to be scanning them in and putting them up here and filing cases against those chief judges and chief clerks that have been ignoring these things and have prevented due process from going forward and still housing these people. You know, in the president paper, we spoke about these political prisons that are out there, these private prisons. We have to shut these things down. And so we have to push hard. So now is the time that we really got to get together and start to really press the organizing of what we're doing. We have to kind of advertise what we're doing to all of the liberty groups out there. We're not asking them to leave their groups or join us or do any of those things. We're just asking them to become educated. In the process of getting educated, they want to participate with us too. That's fine. But we want them to get educated. We, the people, need to become educated. And so people need to understand these things. They can come to National Liberty Alliance, which is a facilitator for an education, for organizing and communicating. But the key is the education. We have a civics course. We have a constitutional course. And anybody who takes those two courses, and then there's another course up there that we have. It's a written course that could be found. It's really just a book. It's not really a course. And it just tells you a little bit on access and how the process works in the courts and the paperwork and what papers you have to file to open a case. And it does a lot of the statutory stuff, but it gives you a picture of the process. And you can take that and use that part of the process. There's nothing wrong with the rules of the court, generally speaking. Some rules are repugnant. We let them know we're coming in under common law. That rule doesn't apply to us because it's repugnant to the Constitution. That applies to slaves. And, you know, are you a slave is the question to the people, or are you free? You know, and it's all a state of mind. That's what it is, a state of mind. Think free, act free, and you'll be free. Lost my train of thought here. All right, anyway, we're going to move forward here and read this paper tonight, and we'll take it from there. I'll try to read through quickly. It's not quite as long as the last one, and there is quite a few footnotes. It looks like I'm just breezing through. There's quite a few pages anyway that takes up half pages or more. Okay, so this is addressed to both Congresses, U.S. Representatives and the Senate. We'll be sending a copy to the House Speaker and also a copy to the Senate Majority Leader. And they will be responsible for dispersing it to the entire Congress and to respond with a comment, respond back to us. Redress of grievance. We, the people of the United States of America, under the power and the authority of the sureties of peace, here and after the grand jury, whereas unified common law grand jury arose out of we, the people, in each of the 50 states, which came together to form a unified United States common law grand jury. This was done in an effort to subdue subversion against the United States of America from enemies both foreign and domestic within our government. This court of record, proceeding according to the common law for redress of grievances, which is our unalienable right, we ordained and expressed in writing as the Bill of Rights ratified on December 15, 1791, in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of federal government powers. We, the people, established Amendment 1. Congress shall make no law respecting the right of the people to petition the government for redress of grievances. We, the people, therefore command Congress, hereinafter respondents, to give a verified account of your stewardship by responding to this redress of grievances by both U.S. mail and fax. Now, by the way, as we're reading through this, read through this out loud. This is the first time. And in the process of reading out, we pick up mistakes. So we'll probably pick up some mistakes and we'll make the corrections. And again, anybody who finds any mistakes that we don't pick up on, get a hold of Jan and let him know what it is and we'll make those corrections. Okay, you are elected senators and representatives that have a legal and moral duty to speak directly to us unfiltered. Being a steward with vested constitutional authorities, you do not have the right to remain silent or right to an attorney concerning questions of your vested actions. Answers to the grand jury in this action through an attorney will be considered a non-answer. Hired servants are required to give an account to their master directly and upon demand. Any resistance can only be equated to fraud. This is our right to redress of grievances. Silence can only be equated with fraud where there is a legal or moral duty to speak, or where an inquiry left unanswered would be intentionally misleading, U.S. versus Tweel. It has been our experience that all bar attorneys have been unwittingly brainwashed to resist the common law and replace it with statutes of men, most of which are repugnant to the Constitution and its capstone Bill of Rights. These statutes create a statutory prison that stifles the spirit of man and legislates man's behavior, thereby the government assumes the character of God. The civil lawyer, by his tradition and training, tends to treat statutes as though they proceed from God, because bred into civil law systems is the demand that he not look behind the language of the statute in coming to his decisions. The code is supreme, which is to say that legislators is supreme. Adherence to the code is by custom practically blind. And that's a quote by Brent Winters, which we haven't italicized this. I do see we have the quote marks up in the footnote, but we'll have to get back and italicize that. Matter of fact, I'm reading right off of the word, so I'm going to do that right now. Make that italicized. Okay. Anyway, that was a quote from Brent Winters, Excellent in Law, pages 174 to 175. Bar attorneys have been indoctrinated to believe that the common law has been abrogated and that God's law, also known as the common law, is no longer applicable, thereby unwittingly bringing people under the will of tyrants. They have been trained that courts must punish through incarceration all who offend the 10,000 commandments that Justinian brought up from the pit of Babylon. Justinian's code is a code of law focusing all on the will of the state. To this day, corpus juris civilis and the ideals it embodies permeate the control of modern civil law tradition. And we do give a footnote on understanding this term here. We appreciate that the 114th Congress has inherited the legislative work of the 113th, and the 113th has inherited the legislative work of the 112th, and so on. Nevertheless, we are holding the 114th Congress to give an account of the present state of affairs. It is no hidden matter that Congress has been legislating beyond their authority for quite some time, and the grand jury intends on bringing our legislative branch back under the chains of the Constitution and indict all that resist. It was by silent reproaches and slight deviations from legal modes of procedure that unconstitutional practice acquired their first footing, leading to a gradual depreciation of our unalienable rights until they became completely obliterated. Before we can redress a grievance, Congress must first recognize that there is a grievance that needs amending. The law of the land is common law, and Congress' continued ignorance of that law places America in jeopardy to be overthrown by powers already in motion to do so. Elected and appointed servants are empowered with various powers and authority. If that servant willfully neglects to understand the boundaries of that power and authority that they took an oath to uphold and protect, how can you uphold what you cannot discern? How can you protect what you cannot recognize? How can you honor your oath if you didn't know how or what to honor? How did you lie to the people when you took your oath, or did you lie to yourselves to take a position of honor or in dishonor? And is there a difference? If America is to be lost, it'll be lost through ignorance. A plea of ignorance of the law in a court of law will not be heard. To willfully neglect to know the law of the land equals a willful neglect to honor your oath, and thereby the law of the land. The charge for such willful actions is subversion and lawless violence against the United States of America. If government is not controlled by the constructs of law, by whom are you controlled? It was an evil day for American liberty when the theory of government outside of supreme law found its lodgment in our legislated laws, which are no laws, through the Organic Act of 1871 that covertly seized control of a federal district, unconstitutionally changing it into a state controlled by foreign powers. No higher duty rests upon America's elected servants today than to exert their full authority to avert violations of the principles of the Constitution by simply adhering to it. When an oath becomes equally a crime, it is in these words I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully and impartially discharge all the duties incumbent upon me according to the best of my abilities and understanding, agreeably to the Constitution and laws of the United States. Why does an elected servant swear to discharge his duties agreeably to the Constitution of the United States if that Constitution forms no rule for his government? If it is closed upon him and cannot be inspected by him. If such be the real state of things, this is worse than solemn mockery. To prescribe or to take this oath becomes equally a crime. And that's Marbury versus Madison in 1803. We have a few more quotes here. Where rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them. Miranda versus Arizona. Any attempt to enforce authority beyond constitutional boundaries is nothing less than lawless violence. Abelman versus Booth. We, elected servants, have no more right to decline the exercise of jurisdiction which is given than to usurp that which is not given. The one or the other would be treason to the Constitution. That's Cohen versus Virginia. That statute which would deprive the citizen of the rights of persons or property without a regular trial according to the course and usage of the common law would not be the law of the land. Hoke versus Henderson. If your personal lifestyle made you vulnerable through coercion to the control of the hidden corrupt powers entrenched among you, among the three branches of government, through coercion, we suggest you to step up and defend the Republic even at the risk of your embarrassment or indictment. If you cannot, then resign your office. We the people come with an olive branch and clemency to all who comply with minimum exceptions. But the full wrath of we the sovereign people shall fall upon those who lift up their heel against us. America's founding document, the Declaration of Independence, laid the foundation for our Constitution and its capstone Bill of Rights, whereas we, the sovereign people, by his mercy, found in the mind of God that we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Thomas Jefferson, concerning these powers, said, "In questions of power, let no more be heard of the confidence of men, but bind him down for mischief by the chains of the Constitution." We, the people, in the Bill of Rights, Amendment 1, establish that Congress shall make no law forbidding the right of the people to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Therefore, the power we permitted and the powers we denied are well defined in the Constitution. This is what we, the people, consented to, and you are bound by oath and through this action at law to obey and respond unfiltered. Unfiltered means without a, what we mean by that is without a lawyer. We, the people, will restore you to faithful servants and indict all that resist for high treason. Congress is hereby ordered to remember their oath and give a verified account of their stewardship. We command that Congress provide at the beginning of all said legislation by what authority they act to be found in Articles 1, Section 8, Clauses 1 through 18. Congress is to verify that said legislation does not violate Article 1, Section 9, Clauses 1 through 8. Congress is to verify that said legislation does not violate the Bill of Rights, and Congress is to identify the purpose of the said legislation. A list of the purposes for legislation can be found in our preamble and are listed below. To form a more perfect union, to establish justice, to ensure domestic tranquility, to provide for the common defense, to promote the general welfare, to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. We, the people, realize that some of the following questions as to by what authority did Congress act cannot be answered, and therefore an admission of error with a resolution to correct is the appropriate response. Congress has 30 days to respond, and it would be sufficient for Congress by majority to act as a whole. If the majority responds in honor and justice, restoration is to commence immediately. But if the majority responds in dishonor and in contempt of we the people and our Constitution, then those who stand in honor shall reveal themselves in their own answer and stand with we the people to set our face against the enemies of liberty. Number one, we the people in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5 gave Congress the power to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and a foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures. Admit the error of Congress with a resolution to correct or deny and explain. 1A. On May 23, 1933, Congressman Lewis T. McFadden brought formal charges against the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve Bank System. The Comptroller of the Currency and the Secretary of the United States Treasury for numerous criminal acts, including but not limited to conspiracy, fraud, unlawful conversion, and treason. The petition for the article of impeachment was therefore referred to the Judiciary Committee and has yet to be acted on. Congress is commanded to act now. See evidence document Congressman McFadden's speech on House floor, 1934, found at nationallibertyalliance.org/docket. By what authority did Congress delegate the power to foreign bankers whose interests are personal profits? Admit the error of Congress with a resolution to correct or deny and explain. 1C. Does Congress understand that the Federal Reserve Act gave 100% control of Congress to foreign bankers who seduce members through lobbying, that's bribery? Admit the error of Congress with a resolution to correct or deny and explain. 1D. Legislators were elected to serve the interest of the people, not corporations. How does taking money from special interest groups fulfill the purpose of government? Admit the error of Congress with a resolution to correct or deny and explain. 1E. Does Congress understand that the Federal Reserve Act has bankrupt the United States? Admit the error of Congress with a resolution to correct or deny and explain. 1F. Does Congress understand that the Federal Reserve Act enslaved the people to foreign bankers and therefore must be repealed? Admit the error of Congress with a resolution to correct or deny and explain. Number 2. We the people in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 7 gave Congress the power to establish post offices and post roads. Admit or deny. 2A, we the people in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18, gave Congress vesting powers in departments or offices in the government of the United States for carrying into execution the powers in Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 1 through 17, admit or deny. 2B, we the people did not give Congress vesting powers to create a board of governor compatible to the board of directors of a private corporation for the U.S. Postal Service. See evidence document board of governors vested at nationallibertyalliance.org docket. Admit the error of Congress with a resolution to correct or deny and explain. 2C. By what authority did Congress create the board of governors that acts like a corporation to regulate our post offices? Admit the error of Congress with a resolution to correct or deny and explain. 2D. By what authority did Congress vest a board of governors? Admit the error of Congress with a resolution to correct or deny and explain. 2E. The Postal Reorganization Act is unconstitutional and is therefore null and void. Admit the error of Congress with a resolution to correct or deny and explain. Number 3. We the people in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11 gave Congress the power to declare war, admit or deny. 3A, by what authority does the President send our military forces to war without a declaration of war? Admit the error of Congress with a resolution to correct or deny and explain. 3B, if the President of the United States of America is warring without the consent of Congress, why doesn't Congress stop funding the illegal action to prevent a dictatorship? C. If Congress maintains the funding of an illegal war, they are guilty of aiding and abetting a tyrant. Admit the error of Congress with a resolution to correct or deny and explain. 4. We the people in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 15 gave Congress the power to provide for the calling forth of a militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrection, and repel invasion. Admit or deny. 4A. If the law of the land is not upheld and the forces of the marshals are incapable to enforce the law, Congress is to call forth a militia to enforce the execution of the law. Admit or deny. B. If an insurrection arises, Congress is to call forth a militia to suppress the insurrection. Admit or deny. 4C. If an invasion of the United States arises, Congress is to call forth a militia to repel the invasion. Admit or deny. 4D. If the Congress provides for the calling forth of a militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress the insurrection, repel invasions, by what authority does Congress act to create a homeland security that ignores the militia, spies on the people, and forces the people's obedience? E. If the Constitution provides for the calling forth of the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrection, and repel invasion, by what authority does Congress ignore the Constitution and permit the Pentagon to call the militia? Just a quick note here. You know, I was blown away to find out it was the Pentagon who called forth the militia. It wasn't President Bush. It was 2003. That's amazing. And what did Congress do? Anyway, F. If the Constitution provides for the calling forth of the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrection, and repel invasion, by what authority does Congress ignore the Constitution and permit the President to assume the powers of Congress and execute martial law and the use of Homeland Security to force the people's obedience? G. Only Congress can declare war. Should put admit and deny there. Matter of fact, let me do that right now. H. Why does Congress unconstitutionally fund an unconstitutional war? I. Why doesn't Congress speak out concerning the Pentagon calling of the militia without constitutional authority to send them to war? J. Why doesn't Congress cut funding concerning the Pentagon's calling of the militia without constitutional authority to send them to war? 4K. If Congress does not cut all the funding of all unconstitutional wars, they are in dust, dishonor, and war against the Constitution, and therefore the people. 5. We the people in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 16, gave Congress the power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such parts of them as may be employed on the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectfully the appointment of officers and the authority of training of the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress, admit or deny. 6. We the People in the Bill of Rights, Amendment 2, establish that a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, admit or deny. 6A. All males between the ages of 17 and 45. By the way, the 1902 Act, Militia Act, said between 18 and 45, but Congress corrected that with a small addition to the law to 17. It was 18 to 45, it's now 17 to 45. All males between the ages of 14 to 75 are the unorganized or organized militia, and are to maintain at least one modern military-grade rifle with ammunition, admit or deny. 7. We the People in the Bill of Rights, Amendment 2, establish that the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, admit or deny. 8. We the People in Article 1, Section 9, Clause 2, establish that the privileges of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended. Bill of Rights, Amendment 5, no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, admit or deny. 8A. A writ of habeas corpus is a written statute to support an unalienable right of due process protected by the Fifth Amendment, admit or deny. 9. We the People in Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4, establish that no captation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census enumeration herein before directed to be taken, admit or deny. 9A, tax on income is a direct tax, admit or deny. 9B, tax on private property is a direct tax, admit or deny. 10, we the people in Article 1, Section 9, Clause 5, establish that no tax or duty shall be laid in article exported from state to state, from any state, admit or deny. 10A, federal tobacco tax violates Article 1, Section 9, Clause 5, admit or deny. Admit the error of Congress with a resolution to correct or deny and explain. 10B, federal alcohol tax violates Article 1, Section 9, Clause 5. Admit the error of Congress with a resolution to correct or admit or deny and explain. 10C, federal firearms and ammunition taxes violate Article 1, Section 9, Clause 5. Admit the error of Congress with a resolution to correct or deny and explain. 11. We the people in Article 1, Section 9, Clause 8, establish that no title of nobility shall be granted by the United States, and no person holding any office or profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of Congress, accept of any present in a moment office or title of any kind whatsoever from any king, prince, or foreign state, admit or deny. 11A. Bar attorneys receive a title of nobility called Esquire. Therefore, all such bar attorneys must resign. Admit the error of Congress with a resolution to correct or deny and explain. We the people in Article 4, number 12, we the people in Article 4, Section 4, establish that the United States shall guarantee to every state of this Union a republican form of government, and shall protect each of them against invasion, and on application of the legislature or of the executive, when the legislature cannot be convened, against domestic violence, admit or deny. A. 12A. Most states' supreme courts in the nation deny the courts of record, common law, also known as law of the land. What does Congress plan to do to guarantee our republican form of government? 12B. All village, town, and city courts deny due process of law and are actually administrative courts that do not have the power to fine or incarcerate. What does Congress plan to do to guarantee our republican form of government? I think we've got to be a little clearer with these two, so I want to make a note that make that what we're really trying to say in A and B, of 12A and B. We the people in Article 5 establish that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate, admit or deny. 13A, by what authority did Congress vote on the 17th Amendment that changed the balance of power? The body of the Constitution strictly forbids this change. Also, it could not be done with the Constitution with a constitutional convention because it would and has destroyed the sovereignty of the state, leaving us with one federal government. Destruction of our balance of power. Our Constitution provides for a balance of power that was laid waste by the unratified, unconstitutional 17th Amendment, which was specifically forbidden by the Constitution itself and therefore null and void. Furthermore, the 17th Amendment was never ratified, and therefore it's not even a pretend law. See evidence document 17th Amendment not ratified PDF at nationallibertyalliance.org/docket. Truth is stranger than fiction, but it is because fiction is obligated to stick to possibilities. Truth isn't. And that's a quote by Mark Twain. The United States Constitution, Article 5, the Congress shall propose amendments to this Constitution, which in either case shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of the Constitution when ratified, provided that no state, without its consent, shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. And that equal suffrage means its equal vote in the Senate. Every state has two votes in the Senate. United States Constitution, Article 1, Section 3, the Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state chosen by the legislature thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote. Clearly, the 17th Amendment deprived all states equal suffrage in the Senate. Thus, it is not a moot point. Therefore, like the principle of the Kentucky Resolution written by Thomas Jefferson, the founder of our republic, which stated that simply by declaring their illegality, announcing the strict constitutionalist theory of the federal government, and declaring nullification to be the rightful remedy. That's a quote by Thomas Jefferson. That is how the 17th Amendment can be nullified. There need not be an act of Congress. There need not be an amendment. Governors and the state legislators need only declare, announce, and act by removing the unconstitutional senators and sending in their own senators that will do the will of the state and restore the balance of power, because an unconstitutional act is not law. It confers no right, it imposes no duties, it affords no protection, it creates no office. It is in legal contemplation as inoperative as though it had never been passed. Norton versus Shelby County. This is Marbury versus Madison. It is emphatically the providence and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. Those who apply the rule to a particular case must of necessity expound and interpret that rule. If two laws conflict with each other, the court must decide on the operation of each. So if a law be in opposition to the Constitution, if both the law and the Constitution apply to a particular case, so that the court must either decide that the case conformly to the law, disregarding the Constitution, or conformability to the Constitution, disregarding the law, the court must determine which of these conflicting rules governs the case. This is of the very essence of judicial duty. If, then, the courts are to regard the Constitution, the Constitution is superior to any ordinary act of the legislature, the Constitution, and not such ordinary act, must govern the case to which they both may both apply. Certainly, all those who have framed written constitutions contemplate them as forming the fundamental and paramount law of the nation, and consequently, the theory of every such government must be that an act of the legislature repugnant to the Constitution is void. This theory is essentially attached to a written constitution and is consequently to be considered by this court as one of the fundamental principles of our society. It is not, therefore, to be lost sight of in the further consideration of this subject. If an act of a legislator is repugnant to the Constitution, it is void. Marbury versus Madison. Miranda versus Arizona says where rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them. By constitutionally correcting through nullification the action and the said Constitution, 17th Amendment, nullification would permit the state to review all past acts since November 1913, given both equal suffrage to the state and a great opportunity to eradicate many unconstitutional acts, such as the Federal Reserve Act, enacted in December 23, 1913, the Patriot Act, Homeland Security Act, and much more. Okay, now that was all put together to make the point on the 17th Amendment. We're now moving to 13B. The 17th Amendment was never ratified. Admit or denied. See evidence, 17th Amendment, not ratified, PDF at NLA.org, for its last docket. C. Even if the 17th Amendment was ratified, it would require a unanimous 100% vote, admit or deny. The reason why it would require a 100% vote, and it still can't do it because it's given up an unalienable, a vested right to the state, and the state is sovereign. You can't have a state sovereign and not be able to vote or and agree with its federal government that they created. You can't disconnect that. But even so, it still would require 100% vote, admit or deny. 14, we the people in Article 4, Clause 2, establish that this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made pursuant thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, everything in the Constitution and laws of any state contrary notwithstanding, which would be the supreme law of the land of Congress also, admit or deny. 15, we the people in Article 6, Clause 3, established that senators and representatives before mentioned and the members of the several state legislators and all legislators and judicial officers both of the United States and the several states shall be bound by an oath affirmation to support this Constitution, admit or deny. 15A, by what authority does Congress ignore their oath and pass legislation contrary to the Constitution? 16, in 2009, we the people, without government participating, set up polls across the nation to elect representatives for a Continental Congress in order to restore constitutional governance in the United States of America. The Constitutional Congress met on 11/21/09, and the results of their labor were the Articles of Freedom. See evidence document, nationallibertyalliance.org/docket. These articles were hand-delivered to both houses of Congress of the United States and all 50 states, and to the executive branches of the United States of all 50 states. And the results were unprecedented silence. Acknowledge the reading of the document. 16A, by what authority does Congress think that they can ignore the people and the law of the land? 17, Article 3, Section 3, treason against the United States shall consist only in law, in levying war against them, or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. Admit or deny. 17A. Acts of Congress are primarily written by bar lawyers, admit or deny. 17B, acts of Congress are primarily written by non-congressional members, admit or deny. 17C, the acts of Congress are primarily written by special interest groups, admit or deny. 17B, acts of Congress are primarily written by or for major corporations, admit or deny. Tyrants in Congress, acting under the color of law, have changed our federal city, built upon righteousness and governed by our creator's law, that is common law, into a corporate state of greed and corruption, controlled by foreign bankers and bar attorneys. They have brought us to the very brink of World War III. Tyrants in Congress have ignored and expunged people's six directives. 1, instead of informing a more perfect union, they have given our federal city, post offices, and coining our monies to foreign bankers and bar attorneys. 2, instead of establishing justice, they have turned our courts into jurisdictions unknown, abolished habeas corpus, imposed an income tax, and has destroyed the middle class, and turned all lawmaking over to the bar, who claim to have abrogated the law of the land. 3, instead of ensuring domestic tranquility, they have abolished the militia and closed our armories. That may have to be corrected. Let me make a note of that. Number 314, they certainly have closed our armories. But I want to reword that. All right. 4, instead of providing for the common defense, they have kept our armed forces in a state of perpetual war. 5, instead of promoting the general welfare, they have regulated commerce, and instead of making commerce regular, they have imposed unconstitutional sin taxes. Advancements in science, health, and technology have been hidden. Inventors have been stifled and murdered. 6. Instead of securing the blessings of liberty, they have changed our republic first into a democracy and now into an oligarchy. Congress has infringed upon our rights to defend ourselves. They have destroyed our manufacturing base. They have taxed 88% of the top Fortune 500 companies out of America. They have destroyed our economy. They have turned our dollar into debt. They have robbed our silver and gold. They have demoralized our children. They have opened our borders. They have sold our postal systems to foreign corporations. They have broken our electric companies, sales to foreign corporations. They spy on we the people, intercepting and storing all our communications and cases in case we become persons of interest. Our servants take money, bribes, from special interest groups, thereby selling their vote and their soul to the highest bidder, usually on legislation that they didn't even have the constitutional authority to pass in the first place, placing the will of the corporate world above the will of the people. Congress has permitted tyrants in the White House to seize legislative powers through executive orders and threats of martial law and monetary collapse in private sessions, when they should be exposing these power grabs to the people. Congress holds the purse and can stop the funding of all of these unconstitutional activities. Wherefore, we the people demand that Congress stop all their unconstitutional acts, stop blindly approving bar legislation into law that are destroying our American way of life, cut off our funding from all unconstitutional authorities. Congress is to review all past congressional acts, actions, and act and attach to them by what authority Congress acted upon. If Congress is unable to trace authority back to the people, said acts should be made void. On all future acts, Congress is to trace authority back to the people and clearly state at the beginning of these acts by what authority Congress needs to, by what authority. Congress needs to restructure how decisions on proposed legislation should proceed. No single individual or small dominant group in Congress should have the power to quell dissent or prevent motions from going forward. Congress is to acknowledge that no state shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate and support any state exercising their sovereign right to lawfully nullify their unratified, unconstitutional, repugnant 17th Amendment and their sovereign right to send two senators appointed by the governor and approved by the state legislature to Washington for its equal suffrage. Any state elected official who does not comply with his oath to the Constitution, any judge or elected official who does not comply with his oath to the Constitution of the United States wars against the Constitution and engages in violation of the supreme law of the land. The judge is engaged in acts of treason. Cooper versus Aaron. Congress is hereby fully informed by this redress of grievance that there are enemies both foreign and domestic advocating the overthrow of our government embedded in all three branches of government, and that all representatives in Congress supporting unconstitutional legislation supporting the overthrow of our Constitution in violation of 18 U.S.C. 2385 will be brought before the grand jury for potential indictment. Sealed and dated, and again, we haven't sent this out yet, but we're still going to continue on its perfection and corrections here, and again, hopefully we'll be getting this out next week. I don't see any reason why we shouldn't be able to get all of these papers out next week. Okay, that brings us to the end of that paper. Again, if anybody has any corrections or comments on that paper, please get a hold of Jan. Go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on directory. You'll find him towards the top. You can find his phone number and his email address and get your thoughts and comments to him, and we'll work on these things. Okay, a couple of things before we move on to the next part of the program here. We're going to be on the radio, Truth, Honor, and Integrity, coming up this Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We will then... You know, we're going to simulcast this this radio program, this interview. We're going to simulcast it in this room in place of our regularly scheduled meeting on COS. So this Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time in this room, instead of the COS meeting taking place, we'll be on the radio. We'll be simulcasting that radio program. After the program, which I think is only an hour long for us, it's a couple hours, but we're on for 1 hour. We then will open up for an open forum for a while, so we'll have an open Q&A after the program. We're also, again, we're preparing to file in the court hopefully next week. This week we should finish up on our paperwork. Sometime next week we should be filing. We need more money, so to prepare to get this word out, file all these papers, and also we want to get this word out as much as we can. We're going to do some YouTubes, and we want people to really post and press these YouTubes out there. We need to get people involved. And in the beginning of the first YouTube, I think we're going to kind of talk with the people and make the point that, you know, if people expect to be ignorant and free, forget about it, it's not going to happen. And the power of the pen, the power of the light of truth, you know, all of this is important. We're going to win this thing by words. We don't have to pick up the sword. We can use the sword of the word, because it cuts, and it's a two-edged sword. And we trust that righteousness will defend itself. So we trust that God will bless us for our actions in doing the right thing, bringing justice, reinstating, bringing the king back into his own court. After all, we did covenant with God under the Declaration of Independence and confirmed it under our Constitution and our Bill of Rights by calling upon the Creator and executing and exercising his unalienable rights that he gave to us under the common law, which is law under him, the Creator of this universe. That's a covenant that no man can break. Certainly no man can break for us. Any man or individual that gets in the way of God and his people has to answer to God himself and face his wrath. And we trust that God is really going to win this war for us. We don't need to pick up arms, but of course, worst case comes to worst, we'll agree with Patrick Henry on that. Okay, let's see, anything else before we move on here? Of course, we're still continuing to build jury administrations. Anybody who wants to become an administrator for the grand jury, 4 people in every county, a paid position, once we get onto the other side, of course, we're going to take the authority and the processes away from the court, away from the prosecutors, and we're going to bring it back to the people, and the people will prepare the juries, the grand juries and the trial juries. We will orientate them. We will call them and make sure that they are not tainted. So building, building grand juries, administrations, 4 people in each county is required for this. Anybody who's interested in that, make sure you take 2 of our tests. We have the constitutional course and the civics course, and make sure you check the box for becoming a an administrator. I don't know if that question is there on the box when you go to the constitutional course, but I do know it's there for the civics course. So you should sign up for both. I would take the civics course first, because that you can do in one Saturday, 6 to 8 hours, you can get it done. The other one's going to take quite some time, about 120, 130 hours, maybe more. A lot of video, a lot of audio in the civics course. Okay, of course, we're also building committees of safety, which will eventually morph back into the committee man process to take control of our political process. So again, everyone should get involved in both of that, building grand juries and supporting those people and building committees of safety. Definitely everybody should get involved in committees of safety, and everybody should get involved in putting forth the word of what's going on here, what we're doing, that NLA is really a facilitator of knowledge, a facilitator of an education, and that education is the Constitution and how our government works and how the courts work. Okay, Gerard, you got anything to add to any of this before we move on? While waiting for Gerard, do we have any questions out there? I think Carl... Jan had to
yes,
run to the end.
I'm here.
Do we have any questions, and then we'll move to Gerard?
Yes, Jan gave me one question.
Well, hold on a minute. Before we do that, Gerard, do you have anything you want to add or say before we take the questions?
No, not really, no.
Okay. All right, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, so one question is, if you can you define a court of record and also explain where the lawful definition can be found? I need to have it as evidence in a suit that we are bringing against the state for not providing a court of record. The state constitution requires the state to have a court of record, but they do not, or rather, they do in suits of equity only. Thank you.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, we have a memorandum of law, which I thought was up here, but it's not up here right now. It will be put up here. The reason why we do have a memorandum of law in another place, I forget where it's at, but we've updated it. We prepared it for this case coming up, and we do get into a lot of detail there. But you can look into Black's Law. You can go to Bouvier's. You could look up Court of Record. You should be able to find things there. You'll find court cases that speak about this that give the definition that Black's records its definition, therefore, that way. A court of record ultimately is the process of common law with a jury. By trial by jury is what a court of record. If there is no jury, it's not a court of record. Even the United States Supreme Court, when they make a ruling, they're ruling mostly on a lot of equity cases. They're ruling on cases that the judges have made rulings on, and not cases where. It's very rare that they get involved in a case that was decided by the grand jury. They will not and cannot turn over a grand jury, and that's very—I mean, not a grand jury, trial jury. It's very interesting. Think about that. Okay, the United States Supreme Court can overturn a case that's decided by a judge or a panel of judges. They cannot overturn a case decided by the grand jury or by a trial jury. Now, there are some exceptions to that, of course. If it clearly becomes that someone's unalienable rights was violated in the action and conclusion of that jury, then obviously they could do something about that. That would be a very touchy thing, but it is rare. That's why a lot of cases, when you see these cases or people go up to try to appeal a case that was decided by a trial jury, it's almost impossible to get appealed. They really, they'd have to find some fundamental problems in that case that are so severe that what do you call the Supreme Court would get involved with. So it's extremely rare. So just to make it very simple, a court of record is a court that the tribunal is the people, which is the trial jury. That's a court of record. Any other court is not a court of record. There are criminal courts out there. They are not court of record. There are all kinds of courts out there. They're not courts of record. Only a court heard by the people, decided by the people as the tribunal. Is a court of record. Now, we do get into that definition in details and also give a lot of references to these things in the memorandum of law, which will be posted this week up on this page, by the way. We've updated that memorandum, so it'll be up here. What's the next question?
That's it. That was the only question for this week.
Okay. Okay, thanks a lot, Carl. Appreciate it. Gerard, you got anything to say before we move on to Brent?
No, I'm good for now.
Okay. All right, we're going to move over to Brent. Brent Winters is the author of The Excellence in the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, what do you got for us tonight? You got to unmute, Brent. Is Brent unmuted here? Because I don't hear him. I know he was here when we started the call. Let me see.
I'll try to find him.
He's not coming in as a administrator, so he wait. No, that's not him. Yeah, he's probably coming in. You're gonna have to unmute him. Brent, oh, there he is. I see him. Let me unmute him. I'll get him.
Oh, okay.
Okay, Brent,
Oh.
try it.
Yeah, I'm good,
Okay.
thanks.
Yeah, if you're having problems signing in to become as an administrator, get a hold of Jan to talk to him for this any of the problems, and he'll help you. And
Okay, well.
you'll find him under the directory. He's one of the national
Okay.
leaders. You'll find his name right on top, so with a phone number. Okay, go right ahead.
Okay. Well, thanks. Just a couple of things to begin. I always want to say that the only remedy for law lessness is true law. There is no other remedy. You can kill all the people that you think are your adversaries, and it's not going to change anything unless you have something to put in place. And the genius, when I say genius, I mean the relative originality of the founding of our own country was that we didn't try to, our war with Britain wasn't an attempt to vindicate past wrongs done. Now, that's the way most all revolutions are. The Papal Revolution of the 11th century, the French Revolution of the 18th century, the Russian Revolution, all the hundreds of revolutions that occur perennially in South America and always have, all of those were promoted to people. You have to have somebody to fight, and they're promoted to people as a way to vindicate, to get back, to pull out a pound of flesh of people that apparently or you believe have been abusing you. And that's not what the American experience was like at all. When you're trying to vindicate the past that way, you don't get anywhere. You're putting out vengeance, and you're not thinking about what you're going to put in place. And usually in those cases, what happens is the powerful party works people up like they did in China, and then when it's all over, they just enslave everybody, and we're in charge. That's China, Russia, France, all revolutions are like that. But in America, we shouldn't even call it a revolution as much. It was just a matter of us saying, we're not out to take out vengeance here. We just want you to leave us alone so we can establish something worthwhile. And by the way, we have it already. We have the structure in place. All we have to do is just start doing it more intensely. And that's why it works so well. So we don't want to think about getting these devils back. And there are some rotten people out there doing rotten things that the last election, we hope that some of their power is waning at this point. But if vengeance is the purpose of all this, it won't work. And so I encourage you to, we have to have an answer. And we don't want to leave a vacuum. It's like that story in the Bible when Jesus talks about the fellow that had seven demons, and somehow they got kicked out of his body, out of his life. And it says that he says they wandered in dry places, and then they decided no place to go, so they came back because he didn't fill the void with anything. Good, lawfulness, frankly, is what it takes. But he didn't do that, and so they brought back demons worse than themselves. Now, you say, well, that may not be a literal story. That may be an analogy. It may be a metaphor. It may be an allegory. Well, even if it is those things, it's teaching a literal truth. So take it for what it says and understand, as we've all heard, that the way God has created his creation in nature, it abhors a vacuum. And if we don't have the true law to put in place when things fall apart, and things have fallen apart, frankly, that's why we have Sharia law moving into Europe en masse and in England even. And they're pushing hard, these Islamic people. They have religion, and religion always is law. And they have law, and they have courts, and they're doing all they can. They're practicing it right now under our noses among themselves and their religious institutions. And they want to do the same thing here. And if true law isn't in the void that's been left, then we're doomed. Even Harvard, controlled by the evil empire now, has been for several decades. They did away with first-year common law courses, a good many of them. That was about 10 years ago. And they did it at the behest of the person now sitting on the Supreme Court of the United States, who happened to be dean of the Harvard Law School at that time. So these people, they're doing these nasty things and have these ugly plans. They cannot prevail against a small critical mass of people who say, no, we're going to learn and we're going to do, keep, and we're going to do the laws of nature, and the laws of nature is God. We've been talking about the militia of the several states, the four militia clauses of our Constitution. Those militia clauses don't establish the militia of the several states. They recognize it. Every one of them recognizes the militia, the reality of it. And the militia of the several states and this is a good discussion. I'm glad that some things were said in the beginning about the National Guard. The Dick Act of 1903 says there's two, the militia is in two parts, the organized and unorganized. And I chafe at that terminology. It's not part of our common law. Those words are not part of our Constitution. And the reason I chafe at it is I think the Constitution and our common law has a better plan. And it's throughout the four militia clauses, but it is said forthrightly in the Second Amendment, the fourth militia clause, is cited the words that we should use, I believe. I believe we should use the words regular. All the militia is regular, period. That's it. And if the militia isn't regular, then it's not doing its job. But to count on government to make it regular, to organize it, that's not what we're after. We're after regularity. And that word regular is in other places in our Constitution. It always means the same thing. It just means that the militia is to be ready at all times. That's why the Second Amendment says that we have the duty, the right, that is a duty, to keep and carry a weapon. That means keep it on your person. And we can't have a regular militia, according to the Second Amendment, unless the weapon is on your person, in your truck, in your car. We must be really ready. That's the point. These folks that pen the Second Amendment and put together the militia clauses, they did all that and screamed their names to those two documents, the Declaration of 76 and the Constitution of the United States. When they were screaming their names on those documents, when they picked up that quill pen and dipped it in the ink, the reek of gunpowder still hung in their noses. They had watched their own country, their own kin, the people with whom our Declaration says they have consanguinity. Consanguinity, big word. Con means common or with, and sanguis means blood. With whom they had common blood, come over to this side of the pond and try to murder all of them. It was brutal. And they even had germ warfare in the plans and planned to infect the slave population and wipe out the greater portion of 3 million people. That's the warfare that was planned for the colonies. They had no choice but to say, wait a minute, you're trying to kill us. Not some of us, all of us. And they even went so far as to volunteer the Continental Army to be vaccinated for the smallpox, and some of them died. Those are the untold stories. And they understood that the world is a dangerous place. They understood that their own kind, their own kin, their own family would turn on them and try to kill them. And they understood that they saw 2/3 of the colonists in America were against them, the ones that decided to try to fight the madness. It's the same thing today. You've got a very small critical mass of people in America that are saying what needs to be said, telling the truth, and then it encourages a few people, and then things like what happened politically, there was a kickback, and they said, no, we don't want people who sodomize little boys and girls to be running our government. We have to say it that way, because if we don't, people don't get it. That's what's going on. And all those folk that hold the levers of power are doing that, and they have no respect for your life or mine. So that comes back to the militia and the right of the people, that is the militia just is, to be regular. That's the word that I want to see used, to keep and carry a weapon and be ever ready. You know, interstate commerce, our constitutional law says, is supposed to be kept. Congress has the power to keep it regular. Well, what does that mean? Same thing. It means day in, day out, day and night, moment by moment, it's going. It's up and going across state lines freely, without impediment. Well, that's what our militia is supposed to be all the time, day and night, ready. And, of course, the Minutemen of those early days are the prime example to us as Americans. We learn about the Minutemen when we're in grade school. Well, I say we, I did. I assume you did. I don't know if they do now or not. But that was the picture that history painted for us of being regular, having your firearm by the door. And isn't it Isn't it curious? It is to me. And this is the way it was when I was growing up. The guns were always kept behind the side door of the house where everybody went in and out. They were right there in the corner, always loaded. Now, is that American tradition? I suppose it probably is. I had never really thought of it till recently, because that's the way we did it. Of course, we remember the movies where they always kept the flintlock above the mantle in the fireplace, and maybe somebody still does that, but the handy place was right by the door. That way, when you go out, it's right there. The ammunition's there, the gun's there, that's loaded, it was ready. Nobody touched it. Nobody touched guns in our house. Unless Dad picked it up and he was going to go shoot something, and we all knew when that was. But I'm saying this is part of, it's not just part of Americana. It's a necessity. Because men, inherently, left to themselves, are not angels, and they're much worse. They're dangerous. We all are dangerous in our own way. Without the spirit of God, it's much, much worse. Well, let's talk a little bit about the militia of the several states more than I have already. Oh, I want to mention one other thing, talking about the National Guard. The thing that people have said in the past, I say since the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and the whole idea of the Second Amendment now is openly said by folks in positions of prominence that it's there, for government gone astray. Now, when I was in politics and running for office back in the 90s, and the Second Amendment was a big thing then, and people wouldn't say that the Second Amendment was for resistance against government going awry. Even those that were promoting it hard, and it was a big issue back in the Clinton days. They were the Clinton crime bill. They were trying to take it away entirely through that crime bill. Didn't work the way they wanted, but they wanted it. And at that time, I remember listening to the debates. I was in Washington, D.C. I used to go in the House of Representatives, even late up at night. I was there, I remember, one night I was thinking the other day at midnight and listening to the debates on the crime bill. And I went down to the Majority Whip's office, and Denny Hastert was in there. And a few other people that weren't quite as well known at the time, but well, Tom DeLay was there, and they were talking to me, and I was running for office at that time, and Denny Hastert, I didn't know him that well, but he said, you know, I got to go out onto the floor of the Congress here, and he said, and he had a big head of hair, a big shock of hair, he said, you got a comb? I said, yeah, I got a comb, here, and use my comb. Now, knowing what I know about him now, I don't know if I'd have loaned him my comb, but I remember all those folks having all that debate back then, and they never said a word about the real reason for the Second Amendment. Well, people are saying that now. And they're saying it out loud, and nobody's trying to hide it, because the evil empire has ratcheted up its viciousness, and it can only get worse. The only thing they have is deceit, force, and threat of force with deceit. That's all they've got. And that won't last forever. They can do a lot of damage, but the truth will always prevail against that. They have nothing. They start nothing. They initiate nothing. They only steal. They steal what others have done, their property, their institutions, their ideas, and that's what they're trying to do now. And they have to be kept down. They are not, their ability to resist is not gone. And if their ability to resist is not gone, they're going to keep resisting and keep trying to get what they want. And the Second Amendment is our tool, and the other militia clauses with it, which have been ignored for 175 years. But the Second Amendment is our Constitution's answer to these enemies, the enemies among us. At this point, and of course foreign, but they're all the same. They are foreign enemies because they're in league. I mean, it's no secret. The Clinton Foundation was supported primarily by money from Islamic countries who want to destroy the United States, not to mention a lot of other smaller powers. Well, the advantages of our militia of the several states, if it were but followed the way our Constitution lays it out. First, the militia of the several states does away with the temptation of politicians to plan and promote war to gain the power that they desire. we'd said a few weeks ago, of course it's still true, I'll repeat it, the old saying, war makes kings, and kings make war, which in turn empowers the king more, making kings more powerful, and then they make more war, and the cycle doesn't stop until countries spin out of control, spending money and letting blood on both sides. Well, the militia of the several states is the answer to that ridiculous but ever-present problem. Is it any secret now, I don't believe it is, that the Bush's deployment against those countries over on the other side of the world in all that sand in Arabia was a personal vendetta, plus an object to make money for them and their friends. That's all it was, all it amounted to, but a lot of people got killed. Not only hundreds of thousands of them, many of them innocent, of course, but a lot of innocent Americans, too, that were used as cannon fodder in such situations. And although periodic eruptions of war quicken countrymen, our countrymen, to a common conviction and goal, true and ever-present unity requires a common generation-by-generation experience, which only the militia enables. War unifies countries, but it doesn't last. It never has. It never will. The only thing, then, that will unify the country again is more war to a common enemy. And then it pulls us together, people we wouldn't otherwise have anything to do with. We have different religious points of view, different politics, but you throw men together in a military training situation and then throw them in a position where they've got to face ugly bullets, and all of a sudden they're friends, and they're trying to help keep each other alive. But the militia of the several states, that doesn't unify very long, by the way, but the militia of the several states produces a generation-by-generation ongoing experience of commonness among militiamen. And only the militia of the several states enables that. Now, it shouldn't be lost on us that God, the creator of heaven and earth and man and all that in them is, gives us specific directions concerning the militia of the several states. A law, as a matter of fact, a procedure of how to conduct war according to his rules. And they're beautiful rules. And if they're read, and not only read, but deeply contemplated, thought about over and over again, the wisdom of them is overwhelming. Our Constitution requires Congress formal declaration of war before going to war, as was said well ago. And if Congress is willing to take an American's property, that's his tax money, and the lives of his sons, and God forbid our daughters, that's afoot now, our Constitution demands that Congress have enough respect for Americans to put that commitment of war and the reasons for it in a written declaration. But you know what else a declaration of war does? It identifies an enemy. Without a declaration of war, you have no clear definition of your enemy. And if you have no clear definition of your enemy, how can you even convict people of treason in war? Because you've got to convict them of aiding and comforting the enemy. Well, if Congress hasn't defined the enemy, who gets to define the enemy if you're charged with treason? Well, that's the genius of not declaring war, the people that do the ugliness and make most of the profit and are in collusion with the ones they say are our enemies. They can't be convicted of treason, not realistically. It'd be nigh near impossible, as a matter of fact. And it's no secret, again, we know from WikiLeaks and admissions of others that the folks they're calling our enemies now are their own children, their own product, their own creatures. ISIS, developed by the United States. Fidel Castro, produced by the United States, put in power by the CIA. And on it goes. And, of course, then after they do things, it goes awry, like happened in Iran with the Shah. Things go backwards because they don't have a clue what they're doing, never have, but they're just getting paid and having a lot of fun, feeling important. God's not amused at all at that. It's playing God. It's childish. It's destructive. It's murderous. And the more that we can keep it to a minimum, the better off we'll be. That's why we need to say, you want to take sons and take our tax dollars and go fight in another country, then you must observe the modest inconvenience of asking Congress for a declaration of war. And if not, no. Well, our Constitution requires that formal declaration. And presidents ought to have enough respect to never ship boys, and God forbid, as I said a while ago, girls, for crying out loud, to war without Congress's required declaration of war. Declarations of war are justified in three circumstances according to the precedent of our country. War is justified in three circumstances according to the precedent of our country. Number one, a critical national interest is under clear, immediate, and imminent threat. Let me repeat that one. A critical national interest is under clear, immediate, and imminent threat. That's the first reason that our precedent as Americans gives us for going to war. Second, another reason, those threatening that interest are a clearly identifiable foe. As I said a while ago, it's impossible to fight one's enemy without knowing exactly who one's enemy is. Well, that was the problem, of course, they had in Vietnam. Is this little boy here my enemy? Is he trying to kill me? Are these people in this village my enemy, or the people in the other village? Or have they switched places this week? Who is the enemy? That's a question for the Congress of the United States, and to be clear about it and draw clear lines. And once war is declared, that foe must be marked for immediate, speedy, and conclusive defeat. That is, we must be willing to destroy as quickly as possible the declared enemy's ability to resist and take possession, number two, and occupy and control the land that that enemy possesses or controls. Two things must be done in war and must be done as quickly as possible. Destroy the enemy, the identified enemy's means to resist, and occupy the land that that enemy controls. And if we can't do that from the very beginning, from the jump, when we go to war, when war is declared, and we know the land and the people, the land they control, and the class of people who are our enemies that are marked for destruction, then we ought not ever go to war, because a lot of innocent people otherwise are going to get killed. And it will demoralize our troops, it will demoralize our country, it will tear us down. And really, these are the rules that God, again, gives us for warfare in His Word. The Bible speaks to all of these things, but the common senses should tell us this, but the Bible speaks to it clearly, so we're not left to wonder. And where these reasons are neither given nor present, the individual state militias, being under concurrent jurisdiction of each state governor and president, are a check on the president's war power. The militia of the several states, the armed people, are a check on the president's war power. Second benefit, and I'll stop with this one, I got a few more, but I've been talking for a while. Second benefit of the militia of the several states, as our four militia clauses sets forth the militia, recognizes it, the militia gives every family a real stake and meaningful responsibility in their township, their county, their state, and their nation. The militia gives every family a real stake and meaningful responsibility in their township, county, state, and nation. Young men approaching militia age will look forward to that responsibility. It becomes a right of manhood. And if there's anything we're missing in our own country, around the world even, young men have no passage to manhood, and men are increasingly, the male of our species is increasingly effeminate. What does that mean? Well, the Bible teaches that feminism is not necessarily defined by softness, although it can be, but really the crux, the heart, at bottom, feminism is following females. Following females. And that is laid forth as so important. It is the first story of mankind we learn of in the Bible. It is a male following his wife into destruction of hell and plunging all of his descendants into darkness. We don't want to do that because we want to preserve our country. And young men need that example, they need that experience, and the militia of the several states provides that if it's observed. Older men and women will take a deeper interest in younger men, the ones that are preparing themselves, trying to get their hands on a military-grade weapon, the one the state legislature says they have to have, an ammunition, and to obtain the training at their own expense. If we do it right, that's what will happen. And take a deeper interest in the older men. The women will. The women will become involved. They'll be in support of their sons. And everyone will experience the experience of what the militia is to the family and the local community. If there's anything this last election shouted, it was that we want local control more than we have. And it did it in many different ways. I forget how many hundred seats in state legislatures flipped sides in this last election. Of course, the Senate and the Congress, same thing. I've not seen this myself. Of course, the change they had in 94 was big, but it was not as big as this. This was a strong statement. But in short, the militia gives every man and boy a meaningful part among his kith and kin, whether older or whether younger, and establishes a continuity between the older men who have been active in the militia and been through that experience, and the younger men. And I'll end with this, and I've said it before, but it bears repeating, like many other things. The militia is one of the two duties. Militia duty is one of the two duties of the people. That's our law. Always has been our law. The second duty is jury duty. And those two duties of the people, we call it the militia now, our Constitution calls it the people. The phrase was lifted out of the Old Testament Hebrew, ha'am. Those two duties are parallel of the oath that our Constitution requires every office holder in the United States to take, from the county prosecutor to the private soldier to the seaman deuce sailor. When they join the service, right on up through the generals and the admirals, they take the same oath. All lawyers that are licensed to practice in America must take the same oath because they're also officers of the court. And it is an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. Now watch this. Against all enemies, foreign, armed defense, that's militia duty, and all enemies, domestic. That's jury duty and the willingness to take cases to court to defend the law of the land. Some people say, well, that's kind of corny. Well, maybe it does seem corny to some, to the intelligentsia, maybe it does. But I'm just fundamental enough in my mind to think that that's not corny and to think the traditional things are right, and they have held us together for a long time, and they've given us, because we, for whatever reason, practice those traditional things. We don't send our daughters to face ugly bullets. That's traditional with us. We're not that hateful to the female of our species to do that. To think that the oath actually has a meaning, that when we take an oath that we're bound to it and God will demand it from us. Well, the Bible says that, and experience has taught me that. You take that oath. Have you taken it? Some of you have or listening probably have. I have. On more than one occasion, and the older I get, the more serious I take it. And I know that what God says, the consequences of it will come to pass. And if you've taken that oath to support and defend our law of the land, that's what our Constitution is. It's the law of the land. And when you take that oath, you take an oath to support and defend the law of the land against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That means to take up arms as a member of the militia, if necessary, and to support our courts and serve on the jury. Well, that's enough, John, for today. Thanks for the opportunity again. I appreciate it. As I've said before, I say again, and the things that I say here may or may not be consistent with the convictions and the conclusions of NLA, but I think most of the things we talk about were pretty much parallel.
Thank you, Brent. I got a couple of comments there before we go on. I want to kind of reinforce some of what you said, and I was glad you brought up that clause about making commerce regular.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and tying it into the militia, because they've turned it around to regulate. And I dare say that making commerce or even the Second Amendment regular includes not regulating it unduly. That's the whole point. To make commerce regular is to make sure the states don't regulate commerce to the point that you can't business with the guy across, right? They've misinterpreted it. They tell us, oh, we got to regulate it. No, your job is to make sure it's not too regulated, right?
That's right. People are acting. It doesn't mean what it used to. That's right. I agree.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and then the other thing, you talk about the war and what the purpose was, and I think, you know, you said not, you know, it wasn't so much a revolution to take things back or extract our pound of flesh. I think we're better off calling it the war for our sovereignty, because that's what we were fighting for, And that's
we shouldn't call it a we shouldn't call it a revolution. That's not really accurate. Go ahead, George.
Right. And that's why I think they hate that word sovereign so much, because it really does explain what it is we're about and what it is we're fighting for. So thank you for that. Anyway, I'm going to open the queue up. Questions for Brent, please get into the queue. You know, we got Donald Trump in as president, and we still have every problem that we had before he got in there, and it hasn't gone away, and it's not going to go away easy. You know, we have to stay vigilant. And one of the things that's going on is this credit crunch that's going to happen. This new money that's coming in hasn't gone away, and I received an article today about the global currency conspiracy. And it had a couple of points in it, things that I didn't know that happened. I mean, we got one person in the queue. I'll get to you in a second there. This fellow here that's writing the article talking about what's going to happen and what you should do to prepare for this thing in the fiat currency, moving your dollars into gold to protect them somewhat. But he says that, you know, the dollar's been attacked for a very, very long time. And he says in 1985, Germany, Japan, France, and the UK got together and whacked the dollar so it would plunge an incredible 51% over the next 2 years. And the reasons that they keep doing these booms to bust, because they make money when that happens. And he says, you never guess who orchestrated that crash. Not the Germans, not Japan, France, nor the UK. It was done by our own Jim Baker, our Treasury Secretary at the time, in a closed-door deal called the Plaza Accord after the swanky Manhattan Hotel where it was signed. And he said, you know, why? Because we lose big every time these guys get behind closed doors. And so, you know, it made real estate artificial. They went dealing in it, and it went crazy, and then it plunged. And the stock market plunged 22% in a single day, which would be the equivalent of a 4,000-point drop today. And, you know, and that's not the first time they've done it. They've done it before. There was another secret deal that happened just on February 26 during the G20 summit in China. The world financial elite agreed to another deal to crash the dollar, and they call it the Shanghai Accord. I don't know how many people. You can look this stuff up. Simply put, the global money mafia sold out the dollar to give a boost to the Wall Street traders, as usual, and the political elite in Washington, D.C. and Beijing. And that cheap money, you know, it's like rocket fuel. It burns really fast, but then there's nothing left, and you have the crash. And so that's what we're up against. You know, they have a plan to crash our dollar, and people better be ready. Better have hard goods. Better move your money out of all these crazy bonds and CDs that they're in because they're not protected. Your money is not protected. But anyway, that's something that we have to educate ourselves on, and we have to be vigilant about, because the more prepared we are with a real currency, the more better we'll be able to help ourselves and our neighbors, you know, as this thing moves forward. We won't be much good if we can't eat, we can't afford gasoline, we can't drive our cars. It's important that we stay vigilant. It's just like a militia. We need to be regular about these things. Anyway, I got Charles from New Jersey. Hang on a minute here. I have to switch mouses. I'm on two computers. Go ahead, Charles. You've been unmuted.
Okay, Jay. Thank you very much, Garrett. What I have here are three separate documents. And Jason was my state coordinator. And when I had them embossed, I got the seal from my county. And I had all of our jury administrators sign it. And Jason told us to hold off on that. Don't send it in yet. So now I have them, and I'm not sure where I should send them. Let me tell you what I got. It says, notice to clerk to file on demand. And on this it says, there's a declaration sealed with authorities. Three affidavits and press release. Those are the two items I don't have for this. So if I remember correctly, I'm supposed to mail this to my county clerk and to
Charlie.
What's that?
Charlie, I'm having a real hard time hearing you. I'm having a real hard time hearing you. You're like warbly, very hard. I only got half of what you said. Something about you, this paperwork that you have prepared, you don't know where to send it, but I'm not sure what that paperwork is.
Okay, I'm about to tell you what it is. It says...
But I can't hear. I can't hear you. There's something wrong with your mic.
How's that? Is that better?
It's like very... I don't know if it's... Overmodulated, you're still very crackly.
Oh no, how about that?
That's better.
Yes.
Just tell me quick. Give me a short explanation of what you got there, and I'll tell you what I can. This is, you know, I'm looking for Brent questions now, but go ahead.
It says file on demand, and says declaration sealed with authorities. Three affidavits and press release.
Is this for?
What's that?
What is this for? What's this? What are you filing for?
Middlesex County Grand Jury.
Okay, so you're filing it into your county.
At least that's what I think I'm supposed to do. File it with my county clerk. And the other two copies go what? One to my senator and one to my assemblyman?
Constitution of the county.
Right.
I'm sorry, what was that?
In other words, you're establishing your
yes.
Constituting your common law county. Right.
Right.
So we do have a step-by-step instruction on the website. Do you have that?
I had it when I drew these up, but I'm not sure what I have
it
to go
is
back
on there.
To,
and, yeah, the best thing
to
do would
there
be
and
call.
Get the three affidavits and the press release anyway. So how would I do that?
Well, look, the press release is easy because you just send it out to all the local papers. You send the press release out. You know, I mean, when we did ours, we did a press release. I also posted, like, in the post office and the libraries. You don't have to do them all, but we did it just to be thorough. to show that we had public announcement. Most of this is just to follow, you know, the procedures of common law and notice. And so the press release, you send it out to, you know, like if you're doing it in a county, well, you are doing it in a county. Whoever the paper is that the courts use and the town uses in your county, that would be a good paper to put in the press release. Now, they may or may not run it. A lot of papers wouldn't run it because they, you know, once they just ignore it. But, you know, the fact is you send it in and you should, you know, make a note that you sent it in, proof that you sent it in case, and save a copy. So that's just proof that you announced it. Then all the other papers, you know, you make up a packet and you keep copies on file in your county with your seal, but they do get filed at the county clerk. That's where we filed ours. Sometimes the clerk won't take them. Sometimes they will. I would just send them in registered mail. I wouldn't fight with them. You know, give them the file on demand and the fact that they got them. And you don't have to, you know, you got to pick your battles. I mean, we fought with them a lot. Some of them filed them, some of them didn't. But it doesn't matter. The fact is you have a record of filing, and you just move forward with your establishing your administrators and doing the common law stuff that we're doing right now. So there is a step-by-step instruction. I'm not sure what it is. I haven't looked at it in a while because we did ours, you know, 3 years ago. I don't remember specifically. But if you get a hold of one of the administrators and that during the week, or John or myself, we'll go in on the site and maybe walk you through it just one time. It's really easy. Sounds like you got a good handle on it. Maybe it's just, like you said, it's been a while since you read it, so you need a little brushing up. But it's just a matter of the noticing and the filing at the county clerk. And that's it.
Okay.
I mean, you know.
For my press release, I was going to send a copy of page one of the Quo Warranto. Would that be a good press release?
Well, the press release is to announce that the meeting that you had when people, I mean, did you have a meeting and you vote on and give the, we had a little video that we would give for about, I don't know, half hour or something like that, 20 minutes, it's online. There's a video I showed. And then at some point you say, okay, after you show the videos and that, we're going to vote on whether or not, you know, the people want to reinstitute their common law grand jury in such and such a county. And we did a by hand vote. Most of the time it was unanimous. Sometimes you get one or two people that give you trouble, and it doesn't matter. The fact is you take a vote, and government is instituted by those that participate. You don't need any special number. If there's only a couple people come and a couple people vote, well, then you're good to go. So, you know, and then you got to send, you should send copies into National Liberty Alliance. You know, go to the contact page. There's a mailing address. You should mail those documents to National Liberty Alliance so we have them on file also. But make sure you keep copies of everything in your county, whoever's going to be that administrator, or, you know, if somebody has to leave, they got to pass that paperwork on to somebody else. But that the other thing is if we have a copy, we can always supply it. Should something happen and there's nobody in there for a while, at least we got copies. We usually try to make provisions so that the seal doesn't get, you know, get lost or whatever, you know what I mean? I mean,
oh yeah, I see.
We had a couple, you know, just for passing that forward. But there is a step-by-step instruction sheet. It's not that complicated. But, you know, your press release should go out the week of your meeting, the meeting you're going to have in your library, wherever it is, to where you're announcing it to the public that, about the common law. And just a real quick blurb. We got some example ones up there. You know, the Coroanto, they won't understand that. I think you'll confuse them if you send that out with it. But that's something that...
Right. I didn't send that out. I have it. I was prepared to send a copy of it.
Nah, you know what? You could send... Once you establish it, and then you... Once you establish your common law grand jury and you start working in the county and you start talking to the sheriff, at some point, you'll probably want to send it to them. That way they can't deny that they got it. You know, you could do it in person, or you can send it, you know, in the mail and registered mail. You know, we sent registered mail to all over the place, but you know, we didn't do county by county. That's the people in the county's job. So yes, you should definitely send it to your officials in your county, and you'll get some conversation out of that anyway. You should.
Of course, yeah. They
may. You know, they're either going to love you or hate you. That's the way that goes. But if you got any problems, call. You know, if you can't get a hold of your county guy, then call your state guy. Otherwise, call Jan or myself, and then we'll get you on. You know, we'll get you in the right place. Okay.
Oh, wow. I'll send my county clerk and one to my state senator. And you're saying I can keep the third one as my own copy?
You have to send one to NLA, one for your own copy, right? And one for the county. You don't have to send anything to the state because this is done on a county by county. You can send it to the state senator. I mean, look, it doesn't hurt to send it, but this is a county thing. You know, we want 3,000, whatever it is, 143 counties to institute their common law, you know, courts and grand juries. So the most important thing is the county clerk, you know, the announcement in the local paper, the county clerk, and your file that you have it as, because at this point, you're the county administrator since you're starting it. So you're there, and unless somebody else comes in, we need four administrators anyway, right?
Well, I have two in addition to me, but one of those guys moved all the way down to Georgia. Now what am I going to do?
Right. Well, you know, they can, if they're close, they can still be a county administrator if they can get there, but right now, it's a matter of getting it established and then doing your training. All right. So if you got any problems, just call, you know, who's ever in your county. If you have nobody in the county, call the state. Call your state coordinator, or get a hold of Jan or myself, and we'll put you onto the. We'll go on the website. I don't even know where it is. I have to find it. It's been a long time since I looked, but I know it's there, and it's spelled out step by step, and it's pretty easy. It's not real complicated.
To get this far. Now I forgot what I'm supposed to do next. That's why I thought I'd give you a call.
Well, you know, I fell down on the job because it's been 3 years, and I didn't regulate it to my memory as far as step by step. But I'll find it. One of us will find it and send you to it. You know, maybe, you know what you do? Send the questions to NLA or
whatever I do, NLA. I'm not gonna reply.
What's that?
Whenever I send questions at NLA, I do not get a reply.
Yeah, because we don't necessarily reply to them. We try to bring them in on the show like tonight. But if you send an email like to Jan at NLA or John or Gerard, we'll get it in our mailbox. And what's your name now? Charles?
Charlie from New Jersey.
Just put in Charlie from New Jersey and put your question in, because then at least I got a way of getting back a hold of you. And, you know, and like I said, you could call Jan or myself or John, and we'll get you to the right spot so you can put your finger on it on the website. Okay, Charlie?
Oh, okay. I'll do that. Before I send this out, I'm going to need to print out those affidavits. So those affidavits on the website?
The affidavit has to be by people that attended the meeting. Right?
Oh, I see. So I can't send this out until after the meeting. But I'm going to send out the press release first.
Right. You get people that are there to sign the affidavits that you had the meeting, because this is all about notice. You know what I mean? So you want whoever went to the meeting.
That was Jason. I got to talk to him.
Right.
Jason was
my
coordinator, but he's not anymore. The new guy, I think, is Terrence.
You need one or two, at least two would be nice, affidavits that you had a meeting and that it was voted on and that it was passed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The documentation of the establishment. So you can't really file it until you got the affidavits, and the affidavits got to be in the filing.
Gerard, I do have a question or statement on that. Isn't that already done already, that process?
Well, not for my county.
Oh, okay. So,
I had that meeting with Jason. We signed the affidavit there. He probably already did this. I don't know why I'm doing it.
Oh, yeah, it's probably done. Even if, you know, sometimes people lose track of them, but they're done, you know?
Yeah, and I think he just wanted you to hold on to it, if I understand that correctly, just to keep hold of it, because I know I have mine for my particular county up here in New York. So I just keep hold of it. So you might just need to keep hold of it.
You don't want
to lose it. And you can make sure you send copies to NLA because, God forbid, something happens. At least we got copies for the next guy that steps up in case something gets lost, somebody's house burns down, we lose the documents. We actually have other copies so you don't have to run the process all through again.
All right. That's good. And that address is on the website?
Yes. Yes, but I'm sure yours is done. I'm sure it is. You can look it up and you'll see it. And so if somebody was there, it's just a matter of somebody was maybe wanted to pass on the paperwork because they were leaving or moving. And you should always give it to somebody in the county if you can. I mean, we have guys in a state that are holding a couple of counties' paperwork for safekeeping because people came in and then they left and there was nobody to hold it. So we got some coordinators, you know, leadership that are holding multiple counties' paperwork. So that happens sometimes. Okay?
I guess
you're good. Okay. Thank you, Charlie. If we're done, I'm going to move over to New York Mike.
Yeah, I think so. I have nothing else.
Okay, thank you.
Where we left off.
Thanks for calling.
Okay, I thank you very much for your help, Gary. Have a wonderful day.
Yep, thank
you.
Merry
Christmas.
You too. Yeah. Charlie from New Jersey. New York Mike, you're unmuted. Go ahead.
Thank you, Gerard, for taking my call. I got three issues here. I've been dealing with a friend of mine in traffic court. This first thing started last April. He got a ticket for going through a traffic red light. He immediately remanded it into the federal court and gave them notice in the lower court, and they continued to proceed. They would not accept any proof whatsoever of the remand, and they went through with the trial, found him guilty, ended up throwing him in jail for about 30 days. And it's still in federal court, and the federal court in the Western District here in New York has not heard it or hasn't done anything with it. Can they do that?
Can you go out and kill somebody with a gun? Sure you can.
I know.
That's where we're at with this stuff. You know, traffic court is a good place to practice, but I would never get myself thrown in jail over it, especially for running a stop sign. At some point, you gotta pick your battles. And so when it looks like you're going to go to jail or be held in contempt, I would pay the fine, and then you could come back and sue them later. Federal court.
He did pay the fine also. And
what did they put him in jail? Did he go to jail? Did they hold him in contempt or something?
Yeah.
And when they did that, they must have done it over something he said in open court. I don't think they did that over paperwork, did they?
Basically, what it was a refusal for him to identify himself and give the officer his driver license at the time that the sign went through the stoplight.
Right. So, but they got that information eventually because he paid the ticket. So obviously, they got his information, which means he did give it to them at some point, right?
Right. But they got it for obstruction of governmental justice and all this. They threw it.
Yes.
The book had
right.
it pretty much that way, you know.
This is what they're going to do now. They're going to do the same thing that they did to those people out west that went in there. Impeding a federal officer, obstructing justice. how you know, because you didn't cooperate. You know, it doesn't pay to have a fight on the side of the road like that, but, you know, the best thing to do is have a dash cam or a phone and tape the thing, and say, look, I don't want to incriminate myself. And he said, give me a right. Why? What's the charge? Why? You know, what do you want? And of course, they're going to get aggravated. But at some point, you say, okay, I'm going to give this to you, but I'm not contracting with you, and I'm doing it under duress, under threat. So I'm going to hand it to you because you got a gun and you're on my door and you're looking pretty mean right now. So I'm going to hand you this. I'm not driving commercially and you're forcing me to give it to you in spite of what I said. So I do it under protest and you are on tape and what's your name and badge number. Just give it to him.
Right.
You know, don't
right.
Get it. You should never raise it to the point where they're going to arrest you and throw you in jail. You see, he ended up doing 30 days and now he has a record and it's like, There's a lot of other places that you could exercise your rights without going to jail. I mean, look, sometimes you have to go to jail. But, you know, it's like, do you want to fight or do you want to win? I'd much rather see him doing a committee of safety in his county and getting people together, because once you get a common law court system started, a jury, you know, grand jury, people, administrators to a grand jury, and your committees of safety, what happens is you become part of the body politic. You have a group of people to go in alone like that, especially if you don't really know the law and you're learning. I mean, I've done some traffic court stuff because I was learning, but I always knew how to leave a door open for me to get out of. And when you're going after things like that, you always want to leave the judge someplace to go to. You don't want to paint them in a corner where you know, it's like putting a wild animal in. You got to leave the judge someplace to get out. So you can't be real nasty and vindictive, because sometimes it's easy to paint the judge in a corner because they don't know the law. They know it less than you do. They're just used to banging that gavel and making a fine. You know what I mean? So
exactly.
You want to be educating them, and you want to impress them with your demeanor and your attitude. You want to make them respect you, you know? I mean, I had a case where I was fighting a credit card company, and they started having meetings in the judge's chambers with me. And, you know, when you go in the judge's chambers, they always have one of the guards there. You know, they're never going to put you in a back room with a judge without having a guy with a gun on, because these judges need to be protected, because they're upholding some pretty bad laws, you know. So
right,
anyway,
right.
Long story short, it was a particular guard. Every time he saw me come in, you know, they're on the front door. They're checking you for, you know, your cell phone, this, that, as you come through. You know, you're pushing everything through the X-ray machine. And he knew that I was doing an action up there. And he happened to be in the judge's chambers on my first, go-round. Well, he was so interested because he never heard anybody talk to the judge the way I did. And it was, you know, and it was a teaching process for the judge. I ended up winning the case because I ended up convincing the judge and showing the judge just through the tenacity and coming back and asking for stuff that they couldn't give me. I mean, I was feeling embarrassed for the lawyers on the other side sometimes. That's how bad they were. But, you know, that guy made sure he was in that room every time I went in there. And, you know, he respects me, and the judge respects me, because I conducted myself like a gentleman, and it was a teaching and learning experience. And he kept asking me, what do you want? What do you want? I said, well, I tell you what I want. What do you – I said, look, I'm going to go all the way up to the Supreme Court if I have to. And he's looking at me like I'm crazy. I said, look. I said, this is costing me a day out of work. I said, but it's not costing me what a legal education costs, and I'm getting educated. So I'm going to keep going. I'm learning from full hard knocks, Your Honor. So you want to try to keep it friendly if you can, you know? And I would never go to jail over a traffic ticket. I would, you know, I mean, look, kiss his feet if you have to. I mean, to me, staying out of jail is worth more than some stupid statutory ticket. I understand he didn't want to identify himself. I understand those principles. But, you know, now you've made yourself a crusader for the principle. Very hard to do alone. And they have a lot of weapons against you if you're alone. You know, today you have to go in force. And it requires almost a certain, you know, you gain a certain political power when you have people behind you. They understand people. That's the one thing they do still fear, is the people. When people come together, and that's why our court watch think it's so good. You go to court, and there's a bunch of people sitting there with pencils and pens. They get nervous. You know, we used to have trials, and they would put us on a separate day. They'd make a court day for us. Even in after a while, when they got to know us on a traffic ticket, they'd make a special court just for us because they didn't want the core of the court. Because we were in the court one day, and the one guy was pretty good, and he was very articulate. And when he got done and he sat down, the next guy come up, and the judge read his charges. He says, how do you plead? He says, I want to do what that guy just did. And the whole courtroom, they lost it. So he was like, I can't have these people in my courtroom, you know?
Right, exactly.
And that's illegal. In other words, they're trying to convict you in a private court outside of the public preview. So that's why you have to have your court watched. Because I don't care if they give you a special day in a special room. You end up with 2, 3, 4, 6, 10 people is really great. 20 would be, forget about it. They'd be nervous. They'd have their guards up. They think that you're coming after them. A bunch of guys are with a pencil and a pad. They got guns standing around like you're a bunch of terrorists. But it works. And that's all I'm going to suggest is that don't ever take it that far. You know, I mean, I understand operating on principle, but what's your time and your reputation worth? I mean, he probably didn't do his reputation any good in his local community either. You know,
no, absolutely not.
People are. So I don't know what to tell you there. I mean, look at the federal court. First of all, it's hard to get, if you don't actually couch it right, do it right, to get into the federal court. I mean, he did pay the ticket and he did go through. So I guess it was ready to go to federal court at that point because they had already violated him, because they're only allowed to rule on constitutional issues, and that is the place to go. Of course, they don't want to, you know, when it comes down to not identifying yourself or, you know, that you're driving and you're not driving commercially and all that. That's all been fought out before, so they don't want to touch that stuff, especially now. They probably get hives when they see that. The reason they're sitting on it is because they're hoping it goes away elsewise, you know. And I don't know what they're going to do with it, and I don't know what, you know, at some point they may just want to settle it or whatever. I mean, he's already went to jail. That's pretty tough. I mean, I don't know what I would do about that. I would try to cap myself out of jail, though. I, you know, there's not much you can do. You know,
exactly.
And you're right. He can't necessarily sit on it. I mean, he went to federal court. Did he actually buy a number in federal court, or did he just send it up there and say, I'm you know, demanding his justice without paying?
No, he did it in the form of paupers. He filled out the form for his form of paupers, and he didn't have to pay for it.
So they approved it, and they gave him a docket number, in other words.
Yeah. And he filed that into the traffic case, the docket number and everything, and they still wouldn't accept it. They said he needed a letter from the court clerk stating the fact that it's been remanded. And I personally talked to the court clerk, and she said they've never, ever had to do that, nor will they do it because they don't have a form to do it, and it's unheard of. Because just the number itself should be suffice to give them proper notice.
Well, you know what? There's your lawsuit. That's what I would go after. Forget everything else. Forget everything that went before that. Now you have them acting outside of procedure under color law. That's a good lawsuit. He should go into the federal court. He should add the fact that they told him they would not accept it, that it was remanded to the federal. Now, the federal court hasn't heard it. See, the federal court knows they're going to have to slap the lower court down. So they're sitting on it because they don't know that. They want to see what he knows. That's what's going on. If you let it sit there long enough, they'll know that you don't know what to do, and then they'll make a move. So what he needs to do is I don't know, at the federal level, you know, like at the state level, they have what they call request for judicial intervention. And I don't know if they assigned a judge to it yet. But what he needs to do is he needs to either modify that. I don't know what he went in under, but what he needs to do is he needs to bring in the fact that they sent him to get a form, that the court said there is no such form, and that they didn't accept a docket number. All they had to do is go on the court file. It's all electronic up at that level, and they could have seen it. So obviously they gave him the wrong advice, and they're using excuses, you know, to run him around the horn and not answer him. That
right.
itself is a, right there. Now he now based on that he could get restitution, you know.
I mean, okay, that's what
I mean, if he's really ticked off and he wants to get back, that's what I would focus in on. That the fact that it's filed and I got a number in federal court and they refused to stop their prosecution while it was in federal court. Now, what he should have done, he should have put in for an injunction from that judge that was assigned to that case to send that lower judge an injunction from the federal court. That's what he should have done.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
So
I gotcha.
But it sounds like he's got a good case. The trouble is you got, you know, look at you're learning while you're in there, and now you got this, you got the CPLR of the state rules. Now you got the federal rules. It's a big thing to take on if you're not schooled in the law. I mean, look, he's at an point that even an attorney might want to take it for the damages because they may do an out of court settlement with their insurance. I mean, he's got a pretty good case. They gave him a number, and he went back, and they said, we're not going to accept it. We need a letter from the federal court. You know, I don't know who you sue there. You probably have to sue the clerk. I mean, I don't know. Does he know that the judge knew that there was a docket number? I mean, if he could prove that, I would sue him all.
Yeah,
I think the clerk, the judge,
put it down. All in his paperwork. He filed a ton of papers into the case, and that was one of the factors that it was remanded to the federal court. And they didn't accept
it.
They
wouldn't
accept it.
Right, but that was in the paperwork that they didn't accept it?
Yeah, well, he filed it into the case, and of course the judge says, up on the stand, the judge says, well, I got all your paperwork, but I deny it.
Yeah, see.
Didn't accept any argument whatsoever.
Well, it still has to be heard. There's a number. It can't sit there forever. So if he wants to push the issue, I don't know at the federal court if they have what they call an RJI, request for judicial intervention, or what. But they can't let that case just sit there and not hear it. After a while, it's going to go bad. And what's going to happen is they only have so much time. I mean, there should have been summonses sent to the lower court.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? In other words,
yep.
He doesn't know how to move the case. And they know he doesn't know how to move the case, so they're just sitting on it, and they're gonna try to do some kind of summary judgment or denial so that they don't have to answer it. He's gonna have to read the federal rules of procedure on their rules about how long a case can sit there. There's rules that say when the judge has to move. And then what you got to do is you got to go in and you got to file in and say, look, this thing has been sitting here. You might have to make a motion for summary judgment on yourself because the federal court didn't move. I don't know. You need to brush up on the rules.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? The judge can't ignore. That thing is on a conveyor belt. That's due process violation. Next thing you know, the federal judge is in due process violation. And then what you got to do is you got to refile it and give it to another judge. So now you got a state judge, a federal judge. This thing is just grown by the day. You see what I mean? It's like you ended up making a federal case out of a stop sign. But you should write a book, how to make a federal case out of a stop sign. But anyway, you gotta educate yourself. I can't give you all the ins and outs on the call like this.
A lot
of this, you know, we've been through some of this, but there's other, you know, there's things that you've got to really educate yourself. You should be reading those federal rules of procedure. And if he went in improperis in a federal court, there is a clerk there that's supposed to help him. She doesn't give legal advice, but when he goes in and says, look, this case is sitting here and never got answered, the judge denied this, she's going to tell him how to move it and what paper to put in. And if I know one thing about the federal courts, at least over here in New York, every time we were in there, they were very helpful. I can tell you that. They have one clerk there full time for self-represented peoples. What do you think she's doing all day? She wants to help when you come in. She's bored. You know what I mean?
Right.
Use that resource because she probably could give him some good advice. I don't know. All right.
Okay, sounds good. Now, the other thing was, real quick, we went to file in the county clerk in Erie County an affidavit and a notice of his status, and my affidavit, and also an exemption form that was given to him by the county itself. It was a regular exemption for taxes because he's not required to pay the certain taxes because of being one of the people, okay? And so he had it all filled out, notarized, and the whole works. And we went in to file it, and he handed it to her. And she looked at him kind of funny. She says, I have to go speak to the attorney. She came back, and she threw it at him. She goes, I'm not going to file this. And she walked away. She went over to a table, and there was about six lawyers at the table, and he just looked at me, and he didn't know what to do, what to say. I says, hang on a minute. So I walked over to her, and I said, excuse me. I says, if I may ask you a question, and she goes, sure. I says, what is your reason for not filing this paperwork? It's got an affidavit with it. You're required to file an affidavit. And she goes, because I gave it to the attorney, and we determined it was fraud. And we had the discretion not to file it.
Yeah, well, you know, you're dealing with people who are ignorant. I don't know if you put a file on demand on the top of that or not.
No,
you know what I mean?
No,
that's why you put the file on demand. A lot of times when they read it, will scare them, and they will. And you tell her you're an elected official, your attorney, the advice you're getting from that attorney, whoever he is, who's really not representing you. When I bring you to court under a federal charge here for due process violation, he's not going to defend you. He's going to even deny he said that to you.
So, what you told that other fella by sending it registered mail, file on demand, can we do it that way?
You could. They're liable to turn around and send it back to you, though, if they're already alerted. But that would be a crime in itself. If they send it back, I would save the envelope, and then I would pursue it. You know, that's another one that ends up in going into federal court.
Right.
But
he usually wants to go after her.
You know, you may want to just give her, you may just want to go in since you already had words and you already sort of introduced yourself. You may want to just give her the file on demand and say, look, I'm doing this for your information, because we're getting ready to do a suit on you in federal court, and whoever those attorneys are, they're not going to defend you. You have to file. You cannot. It's not up to you to make. You're making determinations of law. That's illegal. It's not. If it's fraud, then let the attorney put down that it's fraud and give it to me in writing.
Right.
So that we can go after him. You know what I mean?
Right. Okay.
And if you send it registered mail, you might actually get an answer, you know, because she's got to do something with it. But send the file on demand with it, because it tells them if they take it out of the court, that's a crime. And it tells them how long, how much fine, and how many years in prison.
Okay, what's the law in New York? What's the law on that where they have to file it, you know?
It's a federal law. It's part of the Constitution. It's under U.S. code. We got a file on demand on our website, and it gives you the cites of the law.
Okay.
It's right in there. Okay?
All right. I'll find it. Okay,
right.
Great. Thank you very much. You have a blessed night. Okay. Bye-bye.
Yeah, you too.
Thanks.
Yep. Okay, next person, we got California Diane.
That would be me. Thank you for taking my call. Are you there?
You're welcome. What's going on in California?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
I said, what's going on in California?
Well, not a whole lot. We're finally going to freeze in my northern California.
Right.
Anyways, I think in regards to the gentleman that was in front of me here, I think he's looking for something called the Younger Doctrine. That is where if a case was already in federal court, the state level cannot hear that same case.
Yeah, he brought it into the federal court after the fact, but I think everything's supposed to stop when it goes in federal court.
But they don't always do that. The only reason I even know that doctrine's name is because I have a friend that's in a foreclosure case, and it it elevated to a divorce, and the state was going to try to do a property decision that was already elevated to the federal court, and she stopped them by acknowledging to the judge that she was out of bounds under the younger
right.
doctrine.
But she was in federal court first before the state moved. This guy
Correct.
Started
Correct.
Out in,
Correct.
In a
it really
court.
Didn't have anything to do with my question for being in the queue. It's just that when I was listening to him,
okay.
it came to mind.
Okay, very good. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I when I was listening to John read his paper earlier, and I know that it's a work in progress. Is there any mention as to how I have a high concern about being forced vaccinations on children and how that would play into the fact that the Nuremberg trials, that has to fall under a clear violation to force vaccinations?
Well, we did bring in the forced vaccination in that original paper that we sent to them. Actually, we brought it up more than one time.
Okay.
I believe it was in the Coruanto, and it was in like the second paper.
Very good.
It's an issue that we've enjoined in our case.
Are you actually referencing the Nuremberg trial?
No, I don't believe. I don't. That's something I didn't know about. I don't know that we are. I'd have to go back and see.
Okay.
You know what footnotes we have in there. So I mean, that's interesting if it was in Nuremberg.
Yeah,
they
because that's actually, when you look at that history through Farben, the chemical corporation that actually had the Jews build their industrial complex to actually do those chemical testings and actually cause cancer and come up with chemotherapy and radiation. And so all of those things were brought up in the Nuremberg trial as actual testing on people, because essentially vaccines are, there's no scientific proof that they ever create a benefit. If anything, they create harm, as you all know. But there's really no data that supports the fact that it does stop the disease. In many cases, it exponentiates it. So that was one comment, basically. I was curious if you were addressing it, and I'm glad that it's being addressed. And then my question is in terms of history. In 1863, when Lincoln declared a state of martial law, and I'm having trouble with my glasses here, he suspended the writ of habeas corpus in 1861 through general orders number 100, or the Liber Code, a.k.a. the Code of Governor Enemies
mm-hmm.
in the Field. The code was authored by, I guess, Francis Liber, a jurist and political philosopher from Germany. The Liber assisted in the War Department, President Lincoln, in drafting that legal guideline for the Union Army, and those guidelines became known as the Liber Codes. Now, upon Lincoln's death, after the Civil War, the General Order 100 was never repealed, or peace was never officially declared to end martial law. Americans have been under a perpetual state of war with the United States under martial law and occupation ever since. And my kind of question here is that there's all this rhetoric about war on drugs, war on this, war on that. Can and are they using that terminology to perpetuate that? And it's my understanding that there was never a declaration of peace from that time. So war, and it never had a declaration of peace. And they keep waging a war no matter what the terminology is. Or for what it is.
Well, it's all unconstitutional anyway. The fact is there's very strict rules for you know to put the nation under martial law. Martial law is for when you've defeated a country and you're taking them over. You know, this was a different situation. This wasn't a declared war against a country. It should have never been what he did. You know what I mean? I mean, he could have used the militia or whatever else. I mean, and the war didn't have to happen in the first place. But the fact that he didn't declare a declaration of war doesn't mean anything. There's no such thing as making a permanent declaration of war. And because somebody didn't sign a piece of paper, we're going to keep fighting and we don't have any rights. That's the most ridiculous thing I ever heard. That flies in the face of everything who we are. And it gives them too much credibility because they don't have that authority. And if you read the LIBOR code, right in their code, it says that if there's no active hostilities within, I forget how many miles, 50 miles.
I did read it. It's 2 years.
Well, no, there's one that says that if there's none within so many miles of you.
Oh,
and even
okay.
If it's 2 years,
well, yeah, but there's also if we have peace for 2 years, then
right.
It's...
Right, and they have to. No, but even during the martial law, don't forget, we're Americans here under the Constitution. So if they declare martial law for whatever reason, which they shouldn't even be able to because we're not at war with ourselves, that's usually for when you're fighting another country. But nevertheless, the Constitution, you have rights under the Constitution unless there's active fighting going on. And if there's no active fighting going on within 30, 50 miles of you, then they have to give, if the court is open, that's the measurement that Brent gave. As long as the court is open, then guess what? Then we're not under martial law, are we? What determines martial law is the fact that the courts are closed and you can't get justice through your judges, and so then therefore you're under a military admiralty law. We're not
right.
Under that. Courts are open. So this business that they never declared peace, I don't care they never declared. It doesn't mean anything. What kind of voodoo is that? You know, you come to my house and tell me that I'm under the martial law and you're going to come in, and guess what?
I'm not suggesting that it's right. I'm just suggesting that it's a technicality that they've held us under for all this time.
I understand, but it's a technicality that I won't give them credit for. In other words, I won't give credibility to that fiction because it's a lie. You know, it's all smoke and mirrors.
Absolutely, everything's smoke and mirrors, and probably one of the biggest ones is the
law,
fact that we're all walking around as debt slaves to a corporate fiction, and 99.9% of the population has no clue that they were given up at birth under a corporate fiction.
Right, but isn't it ironic that they're in their own rules? They're not even following their own rules when it comes to.
Because they're making them up as they go, and and they've been perfecting them for what, 8,500 years, basically the same.
Well,
principal people have literally been. I mean, we think it's only happened since they landed on this continent, but this is, of course, we're influenced and being run by a handful of families that have been doing this literally for millennia.
There's nothing new under the sun.
Yeah. So I find extremely difficult, and you know, most of the time I get looked at like I have five eyeballs. It's a really hard precipice to pass with most people.
Right.
And but getting back to also what you were saying about the committees of safety, so have you really seen any success in anybody holding up their sovereignty in an American court? Now, via YouTube, I've seen that successfully done. I don't know that they call it in the UK a committee of safety, but I've actually seen them bring in enough co-sovereigns to actually overtake courts and get their cases.
Well, look at the Committee of Safety is not about going to court. That's just a like-minded people banding together, discussing problems. Now, can they end up in court together? Absolutely. And, you know, we've had our own successes by bringing a bunch of people to court. So what do you call it? You know, when they drop charges and they let people go, that's them letting go. You're not going to find it on the record, but that's their exit plan. You know, where they drop charges and let people go and they let go, I consider that a victory.
Oh, absolutely.
You know? And
that's
happened.
The English a great deal of credit because they seem to be pushing this far further than Americans are. And they seem, I don't know, from my perspective, seem to be getting the word out much more rapidly than work.
Well, I think to tell you the truth, I think they're more well-read, generally speaking. I think it's more in their culture, and they're more well-read. And so, yeah, I think even their police force, haven't been as bad as ours.
Right.
As far as being bullies, I mean, they carry around sticks, and the last time they had a big thing going, the police marched with the people. That was great.
Oh my gosh, I saw YouTube on a training video for the police in Florida making out if the trigger word is if a citizen calls themselves a sovereign, they are immediately trained to believe that that person is a gun-toting danger and terrorist. And that was their training video. And so immediately they're on the defensive and want to kill the – and they have numerous times just shot them because they've invoked their their God-given right to be sovereign.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But, I mean, we've got that's a huge problem when you've got the police department training their cadets. And, of course, in most cases, they just turn 21 years old, and they're young and dumb anyway. They're just nothing but a big – sponge.
Well, guess what? If you know they're training that at a particular place, that's a good project for your Committee of Safety, isn't it?
Yeah.
Find out who the teacher is, see what the curriculum is, pull them on the carpet, and you could even have somebody come in equal time to rebut what that guy says under the Constitution.
Yeah.
You know,
Gerard, I also want to remind you, we have 15 minutes left and a couple callers left, so...
Okay.
Okay.
Just want to remind you to keep on track.
I appreciate it very much. You all have a great evening.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Diane.
All right. Good night.
Okay. Next question is, who's that, California April?
No, Jeremiah.
Jeremiah. Oh, hang on. How come I don't see that?
I don't know. Should be on now.
He's open.
I'm unmuted.
Can you hear me?
Yes. How are you today?
Okay.
I hope
go ahead.
Right on. Well, I'm just going to let me sit down here. It's so funny. My call got unmuted the moment I sat down, right? Just about. But I was just riding my bicycle. Anyways. So I guess my question is about discretion. And do you think that the judge's use of discretion to admit evidence or some things, let some immunity or privileges go, do you think that that's a viable claim, that people need to be making that claim, and that they're not, that that's not what's happening? We're not making the claim of abuse of discretion, because I think that that's the common law attribute. The discretion that a judge exercises, in my opinion, is a common law. It's a common law attribute that is, ultimately, it's noticeable, at least. Didn't you say?
Well, you know what? You're absolutely right with that. And what's been happening as of late, and I it's funny because I had this conversation today in a different venue, something to do with my license as a state inspector. And the statement I made is that every officer of any law carries a certain discretion. They can't, and they want to take it away from us. They want to take it away from the judges. A police officer has to exercise discretion. Look, he doesn't have to write a ticket every time. He can use discretion based on the circumstances. But what they're going to teach him is, if the law was broken, you have to write the ticket. Never mind why it happened or, you know what I'm saying? They want them to be very statutory, and they don't want them to exercise discretion. Number one, I think because if they exercise discretion, they feel like they have to defend that officer's discretion which makes it, which they don't want to do, you know what I mean? It makes it harder for them to defend his actions, where if he just sticks by the statute, yep, the wheel was rolling through the stop sign, yep, yep, that's all I know, you know? So, and there was no discretion to the fact that, you know, there was a truck coming behind him with no brakes, and he had to get the hell out of it. You know?
Well, let me say that I think people should just I want to move forward to another question. Just move at a faster pace, if you don't mind, to something further.
Yeah, let's go. Okay. We only got a minute or so.
Demur. I know that Bill Thornton says that the demurs have been abolished here in California. But I think it's not actually abolished because, I mean, according to the paralegal manual here from 2000, at least 2014, there's grounds for demur, you know, on several different grounds.
Okay, so I'm going to stop you because we got
all right, that's all I wanted
time,
to say.
I do know something about demur I want to get in for you. There's a woman that we were watching. She does common law, and she's in Ohio. I don't remember. Her name is Maddie something. And she sued Ohio because they told her that the right to demur was no longer there, and she sued in the Supreme Court and won. So that's a good tape to watch.
Okay, thanks for taking my call.
Okay, thank you, Jeremiah. Okay, California April, we got a couple of minutes. Go ahead.
Is it my turn?
Yes, it is.
Okay, this is April.
Yes.
The guy that was talking before, it's Title 28, Section 1361, says the U.S. District Court has a duty requiring a public employee to perform a duty owed to a plaintiff. I wanted to say that ever since he said about that. I got that off of Bill Thornton. I watched it twice just to make sure that I got that one in case I get into that kind of trouble. My question is, I was going over the website, and when I went to click for coming on here tonight, I seen defenders of the Constitutions are considered terrorists. How is that going to affect us?
Who's saying defenders of the Constitution are considered terrorists? This is some government document?
No, it's on your website, on the first page.
Yeah, I think we have that somewhere on there.
And I've also heard it before from other people, too, saying that anybody who defends the Constitution is now considered a terrorist.
Well, look, they have, like, the Southern Poverty Law Institute that writes to police. They don't have any authority whatsoever. I don't even know what their claim to fame is. I don't think they have any kind of credentials whatsoever. And they put this document out for police, and they make a list of terrorist organizations, and they identify all kinds of things that if you – it's kind of like that comedy show, if you with Jeff Foxworthy, you may be a redneck if. Well, you may be a terrorist if you have a Bible in your car and a Constitution. You may be a terrorist, and that's what they do. And it's so ridiculous, I laugh at them, you know?
They're making lists of people and putting them on. I know personally that I'm put on one of those lists. And anybody who puts anything on Facebook or Twitter or anything that you're fighting for your rights or anything, and you get put on their blacklist.
If you're not on the list, you're no friend of mine.
I say if you're not doing something right, if you're not on the list.
That's right. If you're not on the list, you can't be a friend of mine because, look, what are they going to look at? They're making these lists. They're now, if they're really making a list the way they claim they are, guess what? They're the minority. They're the minority.
Yeah. I do have another question. My son's case is in Virginia, and that's supposed to be a common law state, and I have been going over their constitution themselves on how they're violating it. Fighting my son's case, do I do the habeas corpus, or is there another route I might want to take?
Well, is he incarcerated?
Yep, 73 years for two crimes, not one, two, that he didn't do. He was railroaded.
Right, right. Well, the habeas corpus is designed to get him out of jail, but, you know, They're gonna do what they do to us. They're gonna stonewall it for now until we get some teeth in it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The first.
I think
the
if
first...
he's in jail, I think you should do a habeas corpus anyway.
Okay. What about the appeal? Do you even bother going the appeals way, or do I just stick to the habeas corpus working on that?
You know what? It's a tough question. I mean, he was in a state. This is not in a federal court, right? This is a state court.
Yeah. Virginia Beach. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean. Yeah. Right. So you know you're at the state level, but you see the habeas corpus. It goes up to the federal because it's a violation of due process. And believe me, if they railroaded him, he's got lots of reasons to go in the federal court under due process violations, you know?
I have proof. I have proof of everything, everything on both cases. The first case, he was supposed to have a jury trial. The last minute, they changed it to a bench trial. Took him almost an hour to convince him to come out. The second one, detective walked in there in front of the jury and told them that I was coaxing all the witnesses. They didn't care what we had to say, and they told the jury what to decide in the case. I mean, they had no proof, they had nothing, and they did not submit proof that we had. They gave him a lawyer that was a immigration lawyer. Didn't know what he was doing, didn't know how to ask the questions. There was people that weren't called that were witnesses. I mean, he was just railroaded all the way. Anybody who reads his case doesn't understand how they did this to him. So I know I got a good case going. I just don't know what's the best direction for me to go into.
Well, you got to go in a federal court and you got to learn the ropes unless you get a lawyer. And like Brent has said, you know, they beat lawyers up in federal court. It's very hard to get a lawyer in federal court. I also heard that, you know, if you get a lawyer that can practice in federal court, they want like a $30,000 retainer. So if you're going to get a public defender in federal court. You're going to have to study. So
yeah, that's what I'm doing. I'm already working on your civics course.
And like I said, at the federal court, they do have a pro se or a non-represented lawyer or clerk, excuse me, that will help you fill out forms and things like that. And we found them to be pretty helpful here in New York. I don't know how Virginia is. I'm going to tell you, you know, we got this case with Joe Robinson, and it was a federal case. It started as a federal case. It was with the Clean Water Act, and he got, you know, he had two hung juries before they got a jury to convict him, you know, which is an issue of itself, you know, that they didn't listen to the jury. But the lawyer that they assigned him, when I read the case, I think that lawyer did a great job of bringing the issues out. I was surprised that he wrote the case as well as he did.
So that's what I'm throwing out there. Yeah, I can't afford a lawyer. I already tried that, and the lawyer took my money and ran.
But this was a court-appointed attorney.
Yeah. That's what we've had.
In other words, they have court-appointed attorneys at the federal level, too. I mean, I'm not telling you to do that. I'm just telling you that I read this case as this court-appointed attorney wrote at the federal level, and I was surprised how complete it was. It looked pretty dang good to me, you know?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Just to throw it out there, you know, you may want to go in and say you can't afford an attorney or whatever and see if you could, you know, what you can do with that, I don't know. But we're getting late now. We got to go here. We only got a minute left, so.
Okay. I'll save my question for another time.
Okay. Thank you very much. It's been good.
All right, thank you.
And this is recorded, so some of that information that people want, if you go on to the recording, you can hear it and pull it off because there was a couple of references there that people might need. Okay, thank you very much.